Welcome to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24th, 2001.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be across the globe. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Well, does it get any better than what we're doing since last night? I don't think so. Have you seen them yet? What am I talking about? In 1974, Arecibo sent the largest, strongest signal to deep space we've ever sent. It would appear, as one possibility, that a crop circle, or more accurately, a crop glyph that has just been laid down in a field in England near a deep space telescope, is the answer to that broadcast. That's certainly one possibility. The other is that the crop circle, or crop glyph, if you will, is a hoax. Richard C. Hoagland with us in a moment to give us an update. Also caught up on this and coming up in the next hour is Greg Braden, author of the Isaiah Effect. And he says it kind of walks right with exactly what we're going to be talking about tonight. So if either A, you've only heard rumors about this because they've been flying all over the world today about this possible answer, or you didn't get a chance to hear it last night, tonight I suggest you get by your computer so that you can sort of follow right along with what we're doing as we continue to unfold what may be the largest story of the year, or the perhaps even the largest story of any year.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24, 2001.
Now to the mountains of New Mexico, where for many of us this all began with the explanation last night of Richard Hoagland. Many of you I know have been told by your friends, better get up there and take a listen. Good for you. Glad you're here. We're going to begin by catching you up. Richard C. Hoagland is a one-time advisor to NASA, to Walter C. Cronkite, certainly an Angstrom Science Award winner, and he's been on this program many times. You know him. If you missed it last night, get ready. We'll recap and then move quickly ahead. Richard?
Good evening, Art.
Hi.
In the words of Yogi Berra, is this deja vu all over again?
it is. These breaking stories that just absolutely go berserk. We're right in the middle of another one.
Well, with good reason, because it's looking more and more like, and I don't want to get everybody's hopes up, but this may really be real. I have extensive discussions with some folks in England today, people like Michael Glickman, who I think you're going to have on as a guest Monday, right?
Yes, Michael.
Yeah, Michael is one of the veterans of crop circle research, along with people like Colin Andrews and others. I had a very long, interesting discussion with Michael, and the bottom line is that the seasoned veterans, the guys who have been at this for decades, since the mid-70s when this whole phenomenon in modern times started, are pretty convinced that this is absolutely for real, and we've got evidence to present tonight. But
let us back up, and I know a lot of people, since it's the weekend, are here who have just sort of heard rumors about something big going on. What is it? Go to my website, artbell.com, so you can follow along with what you're about to hear. Just recap briefly, Richard.
All right. What they need to do is to go to the web and look under tonight's guest, which is moi. And Keith has done a thing up there where we have, let me see, how's he listed it? He's listed it as second evening, I believe, or second set of images.
Well, under your name it says more crop glyphs images.
That's it. Okay.
And also yesterday's crop glyphs images. So I guess we ought to begin with yesterday's.
Well, I actually did a reprise on the number two, so they can go right to number two.
Okay.
Because it's going to take a little while for them to load.
Number two, really number one there, but okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And are you there?
Yes.
Okay, good. Because mine just blanked out. I love technology. I love computers. Okay. Anyway, on August 19th, a few days ago.
By the way, we were talking about that earlier with Keith about computers in general. And my webcam shot tonight, I'm wearing a Microsoft T-shirt. And he said, well, that's why.
Yeah, they want to go to more crop glyph images.
Right.
Because yesterday's are yesterday's. And we'll just leave them up there and they can, you know. So if you go to that page, the first image you're going to see is this extraordinary glyph.
Pace.
Photographed by Steve Alexander.
Yes.
We finally got the credits up tonight. It was so rushed last night, we didn't even have time to credit everybody who had provided images from the Crop Circle Connector and the Circle Makers. You know, we actually listed one of their images last night, and we didn't give them credit. They are listening to us live on the Internet. I want to give them credit for the comparison. Remember we had the three comparisons?
Of course.
They're the ones that furnished the comparison, and I want to give them kudos for you know, being perceptive to see this really is worth comparing. So the first image is this face that you got wind of a couple nights ago,
right?
Which is about 120 feet long, about maybe 75, 80 feet wide, and it looks like a face. It is composed of pixels in the wheat. The wheat has been flattened down in between those dark areas. The dark areas are the standing crop, and the white areas are the flattened crop.
Isn't that interesting?
And you're going to see some close-ups in a moment here. We actually have ground truth now to back that up.
So that's almost, compared to a normal crop circle, a negative.
It's really a negative. And what's even more elegant is, as my friend Ron Nix just said a few moments ago, he said, this is a newspaper halftone. Because each of the impressed little dots there, which are basically raised in negative. They're scaled according to size, depending upon where the light's supposed to come from. So you see the light's supposed to come from the upper left, and you've got very dark eye sockets because, as we said last night, the eyebrow ridge thing.
Yes.
Very extended eyebrow ridges. Then you've got a nose with prominent nostrils and a narrowing face, and the shadowing, like the face on Mars, like the original Viking image, is from the upper left, and there are a lot of people who have never followed our work art. You know, we've been doing kind of a, you know, Frank Muntz survey all day. And people who have never encountered the face on Mars thing look at this and they say, oh, my God, that looks like that face on Mars that people talk about.
I mean, anybody who looks at this and doesn't see a face, they have some sort of problem.
Well,
I see two breasts.
Now, what we've had a lot of input from is people who have suggested that we do a blur. Because with computers, you can do what's called a Gaussian blur. You select a radius for the number of pixels you want to blur.
It's easy to do. You don't need to do that. Richard, all you need to do is squint your eyes at
slide your cursor down image number two.
Image number two. So you have blurred it for us. I see. Yes, that's exactly what you see. If you blur your eyes, that's exactly what you see, but that's a little better even.
Now, you can see this guy is a human. He's an ancestor.
All right, but I want to be clear on this now, Richard. How was this done? You simply took picture number one and blurred it. That's all.
And what you simply do is you insert a number of pixels, like 50, 90, whatever, 100, until the pixels go away and you can see the image. Because basically it's like that old line from Gigi.
Oh, my God, would you look at that? That may be one of our ancestors, Richard, but I don't know. It could be human.
Notice the prominent cheekbones on the left under the eye socket.
Right.
Like the face on Mars, by the way.
No question.
Notice the shadowing in the eye sockets. Notice on the right.
No question.
How you've got the light coming in. Notice the prominent nose with the wide nostrils. Uh-huh. This is what we used to be, everybody.
Yeah, and if you look at the it's obvious where the sun is. The sun is in the same place as the Viking photo. Exactly the same place. And even that shows in the blurring. In fact, if anything, that's enhanced, Richard. That's incredible.
Isn't that cool?
How would they achieve that at front?
Well, they achieved it by knowing what they're doing. This is a sophisticated technology. This is, again, why I say this ain't a hoax, folks. If this is a hoax, then a lot of your tax dollars that Bush wants to shoot into space are going into this.
Oh, yeah. By the way, there wasn't very good news. Yeah, we'll get to that.
We'll get to that.
All right.
Anyway, so once you satisfy yourself that this is pretty damn interesting, then you go down to image number three. This is now the beginning of ground truth. These are images that came from the Crop Circle Connector.
Wow,
this was taken by Charles Mallett, who's one of the really nifty guys over there. Now, this is looking right down the face from the forehead down toward the chin. And what do you see in the distance on the horizon at the edge of the field?
You see the big radio telescope.
Jill Bolton radio telescope.
God, Richard, so is this the actual, you know, looking at the ground, you can't tell what kind formation this is.
Now, look at the scale of people. You know, there's 5 foot, 6 foot people.
Yeah,
there.
I see them in there, yeah.
Now, what the photographer did, Mr. Mallett did, is he stood right on the tram line, which is the center line.
Yes.
And he's looking right down it.
Oh, I can see
those
that, yes.
Little tram lines are so cool because they give you reference points. And you can see now how big a tram line is. Remember I said they were 10 feet?
Yep.
Well, make that guy lie down over there.
Obviously, they are 10 feet,
and you'll
yes.
see them, they're about 10 feet.
Sure, sure.
So this gives you your scale, everybody, all right? And the neat part of what Keith does is we can slide up and down so easily, and you can do the comparisons. And it's important in this work to keep comparing, going back and forth.
That is so amazing to be looking at that same image, that complicated image of the supposed answer to the Arecibo message, and looking at it from this angle is incredible, Richard. God, I don't believe humans did this. I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
No, humans didn't. So down to image number four. Now you can see the detail. This is by Julian Gibson, taken a few days ago. Now you can see the detail.
Holy mackerel.
See the swirls?
Oh, absolutely.
The elegance?
Yes, yes.
See how, I mean, this is like, Ron actually had an interesting idea. He said, you know, he said, I think I know how they do this.
These are really good close-ups, folks, of the wheat itself. It is wheat, right?
It's wheat.
Wheat. Very good close-ups of the wheat.
And it's just ripe. You can see some green in there, all right?
Yeah.
But look at the pattern. Look at the, imagine a bunch of guys in the middle of the night doing this with flashlights and a board coming out with the precision. Because, Art, let's slide back up to image number one, all right?
Yes.
If you understand now that this is, well, all right, let me go back down. Go to image number four. See the grain standing there, right?
Yes, yes.
The standing grain is the dark stuff because you're looking down between the stalks. So it's like having a bunch of, I'm trying to think how to optically describe this, but the light gets trapped. So if you're hovering overhead in a helicopter or a plane, the standing wheat is going to be dark, and the lay down stuff is going
to
be light.
Yeah, so as I said,
so
this
if you go
is
back
a,
up to number one.
It's a negative.
It's a negative. Now, go to number one, and you'll see my first impression was that the dark things were depressions.
Yes.
They're not. So the light is coming from the bottom right when this was illuminated. The sun was coming from the 5 o'clock position. But the impression is of the light coming from the 11 o'clock position.
Yes.
So it's super sophisticated optical engineering on a scale of a wheat field. Go down to number five now.
Five.
Now you have more detail.
Even,
I want
even
to
closer.
Two of these so people can see that this is not trivial. This is elegance. This is message in the crop.
You spoke with Michael Glickman.
Yes.
Did he give you any stats?
In terms of sizes?
How truly intricate it is.
It's very intricate. He said the lay was pristine, nothing is broken, there were no muddy footprints, no broken stalks, the classic evidence, and the Levin Good stuff will come later. You know, people looking at nodes and
Dr.
all that.
Dr. Levin Good, who will look at this. And normally what they see is something that approximates microwave that has done it.
Exactly. Some kind of energy is applied to this.
Mm-hmm.
But just visually looking at this and looking at the incredible sophistication, because remember, if you go to image number one, the light is really coming from the bottom right, yet the impression is of sun angle from the upper left, like the face on Mars, and that is not trivial to accomplish in a field of waving wheat. Remember, this is not a piece of paper. This is moving, living stuff. Okay, at the bottom, Keith has marked part du. I love his little French there.
Part du.
Click on number two.
Okay. Now it's slowing up a little bit because
everybody's looking.
Right.
We will what they do in the biz call fill, which is we found out today. Remember last night I said that there were two images? The face appeared, and then we thought that earlier the so-called Persian rug, the Arecibo, reply or respond.
Yes.
According to Michael, they appeared simultaneously.
Oh, really?
They were not there the night before, and they
really?
Were there the day after.
Really?
Yes. So they appeared instantly, simultaneously, within minutes or seconds or however long it takes to do this stuff. You know, eyewitnesses who have actually seen these things happen say it just takes seconds for the wheat to all lie down, and that gets back to Ron's idea of computer control, some kind of technology that basically does an imprint, like a stencil, from wherever.
Yes.
Anyway, has yours come up yet?
Well, the little box, the little boxes came up, Richard. They haven't filled yet.
Okay.
You have a lot of people hitting there. So,
image number six is an aerial wide angle we had last night, which was taken from an airplane, probably 1,000 feet up or so, by Steve Alexander. Again, he's one of the premier photographers of the phenomenon over there, and we got his credit on tonight, which we didn't have on last night. So, don't want to leave anybody out. And in the bottom right, you'll see the dish. This is the 25-meter, 80-foot dish of the Chilbolton Radio Telescope, which is used for all kinds of neat and jazzy things, measuring quasars and, you know, listening for SETI and doing other, you know, radio astronomy stuff.
By the way, I spoke briefly with Seth Shostak about a half hour before showtime. SETI's Seth.
Yes.
And he said all kinds of email running around SETI today about this. Some of it somewhat comical, he said. Now, I'll tell you what Seth said, and maybe you'd want to try and answer it.
Okay.
He said, look, why would they answer with a crop circle? Why would they answer by tampering with our crops? A signal that we would send out, such a strong signal that near the hydrogen frequency, why answer in crops? Now, bear in mind, Seth has not had an opportunity to personally see this yet because, of course, it'll blow you away. And he is going to see it by the time he's on Monday in the first hour. He's a skeptical guy, and that's fine. And his big question was, why answer in crops?
Well, why not? I mean, the whole SETI idea that you send a radio signal out and maybe get a message back is terracentric. It's our idea of how E.T. would phone home.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean it's their idea. I, years ago, had an idea myself regarding why the glyphs in the crops, and it goes back to something that Marshall McLuhan said. Remember Marshall McLuhan, the big media guy who was a philosopher in Canada who was commenting about television and radio and hot and cold media and how people relate to information more through one than the other, and I mean, that's why you're such a success on radio, because it's the medium of imagination. And you cannot separate, he said, the medium from the message. So I started thinking, why would you know, ETs or aliens or extraterrestrials deliver information in crop fields? Well, one thing about crops is they're biology. They're living organisms. And so are we.
That's true.
And so are they. So I got to thinking, the medium in this case is the biology. They're telling us in these glyphs, in these signals, in these complex geometries that we then went on to find were hyperdimensional and tetrahedral and all the underpinnings of the math and science that I've been working on for about 20 years now, that is going to affect first the biology on planet Earth. And we are part of that ecosystem. The whole message here is, I think, you cannot disconnect us from the ecosystem. There's a lot of environmentalists, a lot of greenies who are now saying that we're basically killing the Earth for the stupid stuff we're doing, that global warming and all that is the karmic backlash of the things we've done dumbly over the last 100 years. Well, if you're a bunch of extraterrestrials trying to impress on people that they're part of the fabric of life on the planet, maybe you'd send them a message in the life on the planet so they get the message.
Well, from SETI's point of view, they want it returned the way they sent it. Now,
well, that's terracentric. And the neat part is they finally sent us a message in the language that we dumb guys can understand, meaning it's images like a face, and it's our own message sent back to us. So now everybody should have loaded image number six. You got image number six up?
No.
Oh, my God.
No.
There's millions of people trying to get in.
That's obviously the case. This is going to be very difficult.
We will then describe this, because just be patient. It will load. It will eventually load, all right? So image number six is this wide angle showing that a few hundred feet away from our friendly glyph, you know, our face, our ancient face looking up at the stars, we have this rectangular carpet-looking thing. You said it looked like a Navajo rug. I said people compared it to a Persian, you know, carpet.
Right.
Well, What we've done now tonight is below the wide angle, we've got a comparison done by a guy named Bruce Otter, who's another Brit who has done a really good job. And what he did was to take the color version of the Sagan Drake Arecibo message, which was an original little graphic they prepared out of the digital.
Richard, we're not going to be able to get this in. We'll have to do it after the bottom of the hour.
Okay.
It's coming rapidly, all right? Maybe by then
everybody
I'll have it loaded.
Loading.
That's what I'm doing. All right, stay right there. I'm Art Bell from the high desert. Have we been answered? You decide. You go take a look. This is Coast to Coast AM from the high desert.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time.
No time to sleep. I've got to run, fly like the wind, to be free again. And I've got such a long way to go,
such a long way to go,
make it to the border of Mexico. So I ride like the wind, ride like the wind. I was born the son of the longest man. I was from my mind with a gun in my hand. Live that life, gun counts in, gonna ride like the wind. And I've got...
take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
All right, see here. Premier Radio Networks built the web serverville land that could not sink like the Titanic. Unfortunately, the Titanic has gone down. We've broken our own website. So, we're going to have to revert to radio. In other words, in describing all of this to you, at least until our technicians can get on the spot, we're going to revert to radio, and we're going to try to, as sad as it may be, we're going to have to try and do all of this with words for those of you who have not yet seen the pictures. The website is, in fact, locked up tighter than a drum. So stand by, and we'll try and do this with words and get pictures perhaps before the half hour is out. Right now, rest your keyboard.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM, from August 24, 2001.
Wow, I got image 6. It took until just now, but I got image 6. Anyway, for all intents and purposes, right now the website is down for the count. Richard, that tells you the number of people out there that are trying to get information on this.
Yep.
All right, so back to radio we go for now.
Yep. Well, in 1974, we sent a message, as you said, the most powerful message ever sent from this planet, apart from Bemuse and the radar stuff that's kind of, you know, the early warning system and all the early Cold War, you know, signals and all that.
Sure.
But this was a deliberate message. It had a code. It was constructed by Frank Drake and Carl Sagan, sent by the Arecibo 1,000-foot radio bowl telescope in Puerto Rico toward the M13 cluster in 1974, November of 74. And what it simply did was to send an off-on binary code, because computers run on ones and zeros, off and on, yes and no. So it constructed, they constructed what they thought was a cute pictogram, which was a rectangle. It basically was about three times longer than it was wide, and it had a series of ones and zeros that came out on the little graph like a little schematic cartoon.
And so it creates a picture.
It creates a picture, and I can just read you what the picture was supposed to tell intelligent aliens if they ever got it.
Please do that.
At the top, there were numbers 1 to 10, basically told people we were base 10, and then there were number labels on the second line. Then they had the atomic numbers for the elements phosphorus, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, and hydrogen. And why do they pick those elements? Because those are the elements we're made of. That's the elements of life, all right?
Right.
On the next line, well, the next several lines, they have the formulas in this 1-0 code for sugars and bases of the nucleotides of DNA, presuming that any intelligent guys out there would be made of the same stuff, DNA, and would be able to interpret and compare their DNA to our DNA and learn something about us. Then as you went down, there was a column of numbers in the middle that, again, in the cartoon look like black and white little squares.
That's right. I'm looking at it.
Those were the number of nucleotides in our DNA, and on both sides there were these curved lines representing the double helix of DNA. Below that, in the center, was this weird hominid pinhead figure that's supposed to be
us,
human beings, and then there was a code on the right indicating the size of us in terms of the 1 to 10 sequence at the very top,
right,
and in terms of the size of the dish that was sent, the Arecibo dish. And then on the left, there were a bunch of numbers that looked like a black and white upside-down castle that was binary for the number of people on planet Earth, the population of the Earth,
right,
which in 74 was something like 4 billion. Below that, there were a series of simple schematic little squares representing the sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto in a line. And the Earth was above the line of the others.
Offset above.
Up, offset above, indicating that's where, right below the humanoid figure, by the way, indicating that's where the humanoid figure hung out.
Right.
And then below the solar system line, you had this curving line over a thing that looked like an M.
Right.
Which was the Arecibo dish, and the M represented the reflection and beaming of the radio waves into space, and below that there was some information in code, binary code, as to the size of the dish, the diameter of the telescope, etc.
So we sent that out in 1974. By the way, I do have finally the color rendition here.
Okay.
So as we're talking about it, that's what I'm looking at, would be image number 7.
All right.
Everybody
so
else may not be so lucky. We suddenly received what appears to be an answer in a field. In Wilshire.
Yeah, that was image number 5 at the very top. You got that wide-angle image showing that in the same field that the face glyph appeared.
Pointing
right at the telescope, you get this image.
Richard, how far away from the telescope is that glyph?
Well, if you look at the scale, the dish is 80 feet across, all right, pointing straight up. So you can just measure it with your fingers. It's a couple hundred feet.
Yeah.
Just across the fence.
Is that
a stone's throw?
Yeah, is that dish manned 24 hours?
Yes. And I talked with Michael, and they are trying to call in to find out if anybody saw anything.
Yes.
Because it's a defense establishment, and because the British are kind of sensitive about the whole crop glyph circle business for the last 20 years, it would be inconceivable that you had an army of radio telescope workers with nothing better to do out there making crop glyphs in their lunch hour. So I don't think that's a reasonable model. All right?
However, you would imagine they would have lots of security cameras pointed all over the place.
That's right.
And night vision stuff.
We're trying to get access to that. I'm going to send some emails, and Glickman and others are actually phoning and trying to get people to talk. And in the next few days, we'll know more, you know, after the weekend as to what anybody saw, if anything. But usually, nobody sees anything. You know, sun goes down, there's nothing in the field. Sun comes up, there's a thing.
Yeah, and so there it is. The thing is there, is pointed right at the dish, folks.
Well, what it looks like is a duplicate of the Arecibo message. in the crop.
Almost a duplicate.
Well, that's what I say. It looks like.
Okay, we've got the comparison up there for everybody to see when they can get on my website.
Yep.
Now, what's the difference? What are the major differences, important differences between...
This is where we've had folks working, and I want to give some credit to a couple of people. A guy named Chris Joseph, who is one of our colleagues, has a very excellent website, does a lot of imaging, excellent 3D imaging, image processing. I mean, he's done some stunning, you know, shape from shading work.
Sure.
Chris Joseph has actually gone through this now because he has a good digital background, and he's found some very interesting differences.
Go.
So I'm going to go through what they are.
Go.
Remember how I said there was a section devoted to the elements at the very top?
Yes, sir.
The guys who did this added an element. Remember, it was phosphorus, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, and hydrogen.
Right.
They added silicon. And they did it in the correct numerical order.
Did they really?
Silicon. Now, this is really cool because silicon, we now know in the light process, is important. And back in 74, when the biochemists put together the message with Carl and Frank...
theory is that silicon could be a base for a lot of
things. Well, that's another... But if silicon was a base, you wouldn't have a lot of the other stuff that you have. You wouldn't have carbon, for instance. So it's not like it's the silicon life we heard from science fiction.
Then what would adding that symbol mean?
Because silicon is important to our being alive. We now know this compared to what we knew in 74.
Okay.
Another important critical element is silicon. So, anyway, that's one thing. The second thing that Joseph has noticed is that the population box is different. In our population box, let me see if I can get the numbers down here, the Arecibo message encrypted 4,292,853,750 people on Earth as of the night of the message being sent.
And in the field version?
In the field version, it's 21 billion and change.
Oh really?
Okay.
21 billion.
Now, I mean, this is what you look for, and I'm going to sound like a lawyer here, is consistency.
Richard, this wouldn't happen to be a message from our future, would it?
That's one possibility. given that it connects numerically through Monk and Morton's work to Cydonia and Mars, and what we think now in terms of this major paper, which is getting really rave reviews, that we talked about on the last couple of shows, no, I think it's the past. I think it's our past, and someone's trying to tell us how our past is a lot better and more interesting than we have ever imagined.
Used to be 21 billion here?
Well,
is that the idea?
21 billion. Now, let's go down to the final line, and I have to get my graph up here myself because I don't want to blow this one. This is really, really interesting. One of our colleagues named Jim Gressrud did this afternoon. I want to give him credit. He looked at the lines, and a lot of people who sent us emails and faxes and said, look at the solar system line. It's different. And if you can go down to the bottom.
I'm looking.
To the last, the second to the last image, all
right? Right.
You got it?
Got it.
Long, skinny one. Black background. On the right, it says transmit of Arecibo. On the left, it says receive glyph.
Right.
And then it says solar system difference.
Yes.
All right. The little raised dot under the humanoid is supposed to be Earth in our version.
Correct.
If you look at the dots under the hominid in the glyph version, there are three dots. And one of them is surrounded by four dots. And if you start counting planets, if you go to the far right and you say that's the sun,
right,
then it would be Mercury, Venus, then you get three of them. Normally people are saying, okay, you got Earth, Mars, and Jupiter,
right,
and the four dots around it represent the four moons, the Galilean moons. Then you have Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. I have a little different take. All right? If this, in fact, is past, if it's ancient stuff, if the primitive hominid face, remember the primitive face art,
no question,
talking about past, then this would fit with our tidal model exquisitely. Because what we would have is you start with the sun on the right, Mercury, Venus, Earth, planet 5, planet K, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. There's no Pluto because Pluto is an escape moon. Remember, our model said that there were two planets in the asteroid belt.
Right.
That interacted, and that Mars was a moon that escaped after a collision and a catastrophe, and this had ripples all across the solar system.
Yes.
This glyph is completely consistent with that model. And it says that there was life back then on Earth, and Planet 5 and Planet K. And then something happened.
Boy.
Cool.
Too cool. And are we to believe that some hoaxer thought all of this up, giving all of this that much thought, and then had some incredibly precise team go out and do all of this in the middle of the night? I don't think so.
No. And if people can go and look on this page and slide up a couple of glyphs, you'll see we've got ground truth images of the crop lay in the Arecibo duplicate. And it's as intricate and as, I really think, non-hoaxable as the play in the face glyph.
Right, and the 409 version, circle
and the
version.
Huge Julia set that appeared a couple weeks ago.
Sure.
So the bottom line here is, I think, I'm creeping up on this, that this is real. It's a presaging of first contact, which brings me to...
Hold it, Richard, may I ask one more question, please? I noticed that our sent version from Arecibo has a representation of our DNA, right? Which is double helix, which makes it symmetrical. If you look at the version that came back, it's not symmetrical.
And let me tell you what Chris Joseph says, which kind of mirrors what I'm thinking. He says the DNA information is unchanged, except for the left side of the helix, which is more angular, like a sawtooth.
Yes.
Either they misunderstood what we were implying, which I strongly doubt, or they are stating that they have engineered their own genes. Now, Joseph's working on the idea that it's aliens, and my model says it's us, so they're telling us, in my version, that they engineered our genes, boys and girls. Okay?
I guess you could look at it that way.
Well, that's where the big head comes in.
I'd probably rather not look at it that way.
Why?
But
that's
well,
what Sitchin has been saying.
I know.
I mean, there is a consistency here which you got to look at right, pun intended, in the face. And the large head implied to me when I saw it was that they were saying they did something to increase our intelligence. They increased our consciousness. They made us more of what it is to be human. Then we did all this neat stuff.
Well, let's hope
something
it doesn't.
Happened,
let's hope it doesn't.
We've forgotten it all.
Let's hope it doesn't represent ego.
The point is that I'm dying to see what Seth thinks about this.
Well,
because if he really looks at this and starts to compare, and we can get him over the it can't be real.
Seth is skeptical. However, when he really sees this and he hears this explanation, and he has promised he will by the time he comes on the air Monday. We'll see.
Well, we also then should read the Tides paper, because that provides the scientific background for missing planets, which this glyph seems to be duplicating.
As I said, there's a big buzz going around SETI. I mean, emails flying like crazy right now. So, listen, everybody's... whoever did this, or whatever did this, has everybody's attention as of now.
Well, it certainly seems to have the attention of the White House, which brings me to something I wanted to bring up. After our little conversation this afternoon regarding the new appointment of the head of the Joint Chiefs,
yes,
I put in a call to our favorite Washington...
Well, we didn't tell the audience, just in case they don't know. The nomination is Air Force General Richard Myers, an expert on what? Space, military
space
issues.
Military systems.
Going to be the
head
next...
of the Space Command from 1998 to 2000.
Going to be chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs. Now, what does that tell you about the direction we're headed, folks?
Well, I called Steve Bassett, and I basically had him prepare a white paper, which obviously I don't have time to go through, but he has found a disturbing pattern in the Bush appointments, which is people that are either military or ex-military in key positions, you know, Colin Powell, former general, now Secretary of State, et cetera, Richard Cheney, Vice President, and then into the Secretary of Defense. It just implies that somebody is getting ready for something.
Yeah.
And if this is real, if this is a real signal...
Well, look, our defense job, Richard, is to always be ready.
Yeah, but
however,
there's a difference between being ready and being proactively aggressive.
That's right. It looks as though we're hell-bent on putting lots of weapons
in
space.
Orbit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, of course, Steve Greer and I are in total agreement that it's the stupidest thing you can imagine, because if we're dealing with folks who can rearrange planetary systems and tinker with DNA and intercept messages 27 light years out and leave crop glyphs without any visible means of support,
yes,
you know, it's kind of those, you don't do two things. You don't piss into the wind. You don't tug on Superman's cape.
That's right.
Which I would add number three. You don't put our stupid, dumb weapons in orbit to maybe tick off somebody who's trying to be really, 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 really delicate about, hey, guys, this is what you used to be. And I see this now as a major power play, and I want to bring it down to the real world.
But how else would you expect our military to react, Richard? Their job is to prepare.
But not to invade or to shoot down or to take proactive, aggressive action. And that's what I'm really not wanting to see happen.
Yeah, I don't want to see a shootout.
And I want to be absolutely clear on the record that if that were to happen, this extraordinary opportunity would disappear.
As might we.
As might we. That was my next line, Art. You're reading my mind. But I do think on the upside that if these guys are as smart as I think they are in terms of, I mean, they spent 20 years doing this, building gradually more and more sophisticated things. Then they finally pop the biggie, which is us on Mars, connected to a glyph we sent out, coming back changed. According to Glickman, and you're going to get, obviously, him to go into it in great depth on Monday night, he thinks this represents a new era in the whole phenomenon, and I would tend to agree with him. I think we're on the threshold in this extraordinary year that my dear friend Arthur tried to tell us about of something almost unimaginable.
And soon. Soon, Richard. That's the universal conclusion that whatever it is, it's coming really soon. All right, well, listen, we're winding this up. I know that some out there you want to plug. You've got something coming up, right?
Well,
so do it quick.
We only get an hour every time we
That's
get
right.
an hour. So I'm going to be
right.
in the Bay Area in September on the 15th and 16th, speaking at the BayCon. That number, if you want to get tickets to sit through some workshops where we're going to lay out this and a lot more, 408-266-4749.
Do it again.
408-266-4749.
Bay Area, what day?
15th and 16th of September, that
okay.
weekend.
And you're going to be laying out all this new...
All this, and there's other little things that next time I come on, there's some new news regarding Enterprise, and my dear old friend, no longer with us, Gene Roddenberry. I don't want to spoil it tonight because we got a cute little surprise there.
Okay.
And there is a spacecraft en route to Mars that we wanted to test the tidal model called Odyssey.
Right.
Which just coincidentally has now lost a key instrument.
I know, they're working hard trying to get it back.
The radiation measuring instrument, Maria, which would be a critical part of testing our model, suddenly went bonkers last week,
Richard,
right after we published the paper.
Out of time, Richard. Say goodnight.
Say goodnight.
See
later,
you,
my friend.
See you later, Richard. There's your update, folks. Website will be up soon. Check it out. I'm Art Bell.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up.
To play my
Premier Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24th, 2001.
Perhaps the heaviest test our servers have ever faced. And they're down for the count. A few people are getting through, but it's a disaster up there. The reason is this. We sent out a signal from Arecibo in 1974. Appearing in a field near a deep space telescope appears to be the answer to that signal. Or it's an intricate fake, beyond all reason and belief to imagine that man has done. But some do imagine that, as opposed to the alternative. Certainly these images are going to remain there all weekend long. Technicians are on the way right now, trying to get things, rebooted or whatever it is they've gotta do. But obviously, the website's getting slammed, so, just keep trying. You will get through. There are some fascinating comparisons for you up there tonight. Coming up in a moment, author of The Isaiah Effect, Greg Braden, will get his reaction to all of this on a pretty wild night. Don't touch that dial.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24, 2001.
The Isaiah Effect, that's what we're going to be talking about tonight with Greg Braden. Let's read a little bit about that. This, three, in fact, groundbreaking experiments in the late 1990s unveiled dramatic and undeniable evidence of a newly discovered form of energy, a matrix, if you will, linking each member of our global family, creation, and the events of our lives in unexpected and empowering ways. Relegated to technical journals and receiving little attention from mainstream media, these experiments, reported by leading research institutions of our day, shake the foundation of our predominant worldview, scientifically documenting that, one, we communicate with our world, get this, folks, through a previously unrecognized form of energy that operates outside the bounds of measured time and space. Two, our DNA directly influences our physical world through a form of energy that has been previously overlooked. Three, we influence our physical DNA through a non-physical form of energy that is directly linked to prayer. That's right, prayer and human emotion. Greg Braden, author of The Isaiah Effect, suggests that these and other equally empowering principles have been lost to the West through the editing and destruction of great repositories of scientific wisdom, and we'll find out more about that. Greg Braden is a very interesting fellow. He's been a featured guest for international conferences and media specials, bridging ancient wisdom and modern science, a former Earth scientist and senior aerospace computer systems designer, Phillips Petroleum, Martin Marietta Aerospace, and Cisco Systems. Braden is now considered a leading authority on the spiritual philosophy of the ancient and indigenous traditions throughout the world. Here's Greg Braden. Greg, welcome to the program.
Well, good morning, Art. It's a pleasure to be here and hear your voice.
Good to have you. And I, in the last day or so, I've been speaking with you about this whole thing coming down in wheat fields in Great Britain, and of course the message that went out from Arecibo and all the rest of it, and I know you've had a chance to look, and I thought I would solicit your immediate reaction if I could.
So we'll start with all the easy questions first tonight, and then we'll work into the big stuff. Tonight is your Northern New Mexico night, I guess.
I guess.
I know Richard Hogan was on earlier, actually from Southern New Mexico.
Yes.
And I'm speaking to you from the mountains of northern New Mexico this evening. And, you know, I sensed you might ask a question like that as I was listening to the introduction. And I think before we even get into this, Art, we're just going to cover so much material over these next 2 hours. I'd just like to make a statement about context, the context within which all of these mysteries are unfolding in our lives and many of the programs of previous guests. Almost universally, ancient texts and traditions say that this is a very unique time in human as well as cosmic history.
Why? And why is it unique? It's 2001, well, and that's unique because it was made that way by a novel and a motion picture, and so I guess we all have great expectations.
Well, the text and many ancient indigenous traditions, Mayan, Egyptian, certainly the ancient Essene traditions, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, Native North and South American oral traditions, in their own ways, they all say that in at this time, at the close of the last millennium and the birth of this new century, that we could expect to see unusual phenomenon. Our own science now, I come from the world of science, and what I'm finding is that our scientists are finding what they consider to be anomalous, discrete, unrelated phenomenon, unprecedented in our recorded history.
It is true.
Solar bursts, magnetic flips, magnetic declines.
So much so, Greg, that our greatest minds, you know, our greatest theoretical physicists are having to reevaluate very quickly what they think might be true.
Well, certainly, and I've had the honor to share the stage with some of those physicists at conferences in the last few months, Michio Kaku, to mention...
Yeah, they're scrambling.
Well, they are, and so the context, there is a framework in other traditions that allow for the kinds of phenomena we're seeing. Our Western tradition never really allowed for that. So to us, and to science, you know, science is relatively new. It's only 300 or 400 years old, the scientific method. So to our science, these events don't really have a frame of reference on the one hand. And when we look at other traditions, there is a frame of reference. And the bottom line is that this is a time of great change. It's an opportunity for us to know who we are, how we relate to creation, our origins, our capabilities, the capabilities, the latent capabilities that live within our bodies. And it's within that context that we're seeing the phenomenon such as the crop circles. So I wanted to say that this is kind of a foundation that we'll tie back into.
All right. By the way, our website is really experiencing just unprecedented amounts of traffic right now. And so before we call for people to look at any images, let us wait until I get word that we can do that again. We can't do it right now.
I actually tried to get on just before the show.
Yeah.
We put some images up there earlier today that I'll reference.
I know, but please don't reference them yet.
Oh, well, I couldn't see them.
Yeah, that's right.
So what I'd like to say about the crop circles, right? I've been deeply involved with many researchers from many walks of life. Crop circles, the Shroud of Turin researchers, Dead Sea Scrolls, Egyptologists, geneticists, and we're going to bring all that to bear on the mystery of tonight. Many people have asked me whether or not I believe this crop circle phenomenon is authentic or if it's a hoax. And what I can say is I was in the fields in 1993 and 94 studying the crop circles.
Yes.
And they were appearing at the rate of 10 to 12 a night.
Right.
In fields where they hadn't been only 6 hours earlier, over 500 per month in England alone.
Greg, what was it like in those circles?
We were among one particular one. We were was with Colin Andrews and many of the researchers were there at the conference. There was one field. We were standing in the field at sunset, about 8:30 in the evening. There were no glyphs there, and by 5 a.m. the next morning, there was a glyph 2 football fields long. And we were some of the first there is why I'm mentioning this, so it hadn't been trampled down yet.
Well, when you did get there, were there any signs that you saw of human activity that produced it?
Absolutely not. There were no... When you walk through those fields, I mean, even one person, a single time, you leave a path
right.
of broken stalks. There were no paths like that. And the stalks themselves, within the glyphs, are generally not broken. This is what's so interesting. They are gently bent. Between a 45 and a 90 degree angle. They are not broken. They'll still grow. They'll still produce their fruit. And they are interwoven together. They are not simply lying down. They're actually woven together in a way that is just, it's amazing to be able to see it. The seeds are from these glyphs are different. They have different properties from the seeds outside the glyphs for about 90 days. After the glyph is formed, you know, we no longer call them crop circles because they're so complex.
Yes.
For about 90 days after they're formed, when you take a seed from inside a glyph and and germinate it with a seed that was not in that glyph. The seeds from within the glyph, they germinate faster, they develop quicker, they produce more berries per fruit, and then the curve levels out after about 90 days.
Yes, and there's one more thing. Dr. Levengood, as you know, has, as a means of validating these glyphs or circles, looked at molecular changes that occur that allow the kind of bending you were talking about, and it approximates being cooked. It approximates microwave of some sort.
Precisely, and this is going to be important. We'll talk about this in just a little while, and we talk about possible sources and methods. So I just wanted to say this from my experience. While I certainly acknowledge there are hoaxed crop circles out there, both in North America and England, these things are being found not only in the fields. They're being found in the deserts, in dry sand, in sage, in sand bars, in the Rio Grande River, in ice.
Even snow, yes.
In the river. So there's obviously a phenomenon that's happening here. I had the opportunity this afternoon to look and actually do some comparisons, and I spoke with Richard Hoagland about these earlier, at the Arecibo glyph. And there are some, and maybe you've spoken about this in the last hour, there are some obvious differences in the glyph that was returned from the one that was sent from Arecibo. And that's certainly where we're focusing. And one of those is with the description of the genetics of the being that's depicted.
Correct.
The second is the being itself, and the third is the formation of the solar system that we appear to be a part of. So I'm going to start with the last one first. The solar system depicted in the return glyph is singling out Earth, Mars, and whatever planet it is that used to be between Mars and Jupiter.
Precisely.
And those three planets in ancient traditions, there's a long history in some traditions, suggesting that that's actually our original home, if we can say that without even having laid the foundation.
No, we can say that. Honestly.
And I think that says volumes right there, and then we probably will tie back into that in just a little while. The image of the body itself, and I heard Richard's program from last night. One was called the pinhead image, and one was the larger.
We would be the pinheads.
We would be the pinheads, and then there was the larger bulbous image. Many people I've spoken with today kept thinking ET, and while it's certainly easy to have that response, I've got to say the longer I looked at this, and within the context of the rest of the glyph, what I began to see from this is it looks more embryonic than it does ET to me.
Well, then I got to looking at the DNA, and I looked at number two that you've listed in the Isaiah effect. Our DNA directly influences our physical world through a form of energy that has been previously overlooked. And, of course, we depict our DNA in the message sent from Arecibo, and what's over there on the left in the message that allegedly came back, it's different, Greg.
Well, it does look different, and this is where the bulk of my adult life has been spent searching for the principles of unity that bind our family of humankind together, and that has given me the opportunity to work with researchers in many specified fields, including geneticists. And I'll say right off, I am not a geneticist. I'm still learning. What I have come to understand, Art, is typically we talk about four DNA bases for the human genome. What we do not often hear is there's actually a fifth base that is a form. The four bases, cytosine, thymine, adenine, guanine, are very well known. There's a fifth base that occurs, we see it at birth and very early in life. And it is called a 5-MC, or 5-methylcytosine. It's actually a form of the cytosine. And this base, without going into tremendous detail, it plays a significant role in telling the cells which portions of the DNA to replicate and which portions not to replicate. And this has a tremendous implication in terms of aging and health and immune systems.
Right.
And as we begin to... the aging process that begins at birth we begin to lose the qualities of that fifth element of DNA, and that many researchers now are believing is responsible for the aging and diseasing that we're seeing. So up to 6% of the cytosine bases at birth are of this fifth type of DNA, and this glyph is showing an altered DNA. And if we look at this as an embryonic image, rather than as an alien or an off-planet image, it may be telling us something very important about ourselves. And this context, when we look back at the glyphs that have occurred primarily in England and all over the world since 1994, there is a recurrent theme, whether it's through the language of electronics or sacred geometry or planetary science and cosmology. All of them keep pointing back to us, telling us something about ourselves. And I think this particular glyph may just be a Rosetta Stone of glyphs. And once we understand this, I think the other's going to make tremendously more sense to us.
Well, with the intricate detail and sublime differences between what was sent and what has been received, and now recognized as received, it almost seems impossible to me that human beings could have done this. I suppose it's got to be within the realm of possibility. But for me, it's much easier to believe it's either A, alien, or B, a message from time, either our own far past or our own distant future, or, I don't know, almost anything other than a couple of guys with boards and chains. I don't buy that, do you?
Well, I don't buy that. And while I've seen from the air, I've seen glyphs hoaxed, and from the air they look pretty good. When you get up close, there's absolutely no comparison art. When you see the very fine delineation between the standing crops and where the glyph begins, and the interwoven nature, there are actually in one of our first books, Awakening the Zero Point, there is actually a photograph of this interwoven nature of the crops, and I just don't know how anyone could weave those stocks together to such a degree, covering so many acres in such a brief period of time, and do so so consistently. So it'll be interesting, I think, on this glyph, when the researchers actually get there to test the seeds and see if the magnetic fluctuations are there, see if the microwave fluctuations are there, and I think we'll know more about that.
Mm-hmm, no doubt. If you had to make a guess right now, a hoaxer, or aliens, or human beings, either from the future or the past, where would you be guessing?
Well, when I look at these, I'm looking at how they're made, where they come from, and what the message is, and there are three different ways to look at them. We understand, I think, the mechanism. Some of them actually, I think, originate from human consciousness. Others are coming, obviously, from somewhere else. And the message is a message that keeps playing back to us.
All right.
Well, yeah, I hear the music, so we can pick it up after.
That's right, and we'll pick it right up at the message. I'm Art Bell, and from the high desert in the middle of the night, this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time.
the storm. Riders of the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone and actor out alone. Riders on the storm. There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM. From August 24, 2001.
Hey, I've got an idea. What if these prop glyphs, prop circles, these apparent answers to what we sent from Arecibo, are us? In other words, we've been talking about the collective consciousness, right? What if it's a message from the collective id? From us. Actually, from inside all of us. I don't know. Just thought I'd toss that one into the mix.
Now, we take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Hey, you know what? At about 2:30 Saturday afternoon, tomorrow, today or tomorrow, depending on your time zone, I'm going to do an interview with London Broadcasting Corporation, about a 10-minute interview or something, prior to the first and perhaps only running of an entire Coast to Coast AM program on LBC London Broadcasting. If you can find your way to the website, you'd be able to hear that interview and then the broadcast itself. So for the first time, people in London are going to get exposed to this program. Now, returning to my little thought, if you read the second item in the Isaiah Effect, the Isaiah Effect is Greg Braden's new book. He says, our DNA directly influences our physical world through a form of energy that has been previously overlooked. Now, if that would be true, then my little idea might have some merit. In other words, I said, what if it, in effect, is a message from the collective id produced through the energy emanating from our collective DNA? Greg?
Well, this is how the synchronicity works, Art. You're about two station breaks ahead of me.
Yeah, well, sorry about that. Well, it just came to me.
Without even having defined some of the terms I know we'll get into in just a little while, from the perspective of new physics, of quantum physics, the concept of what we call the quantum hologram, the whole concept of them and us starts to get a little fuzzy, and it becomes more we, because it says although we may be physically in one location and our off-planet family may be somewhere else, that we are all communicating through a matrix or a web of energy. The ancient Hopi called it the web of spider grandmother.
And remote viewers have another name for it.
What do the remote viewers call it?
The collective consciousness.
Precisely. And, you know, the whole concept of remote viewing, I know we'll get into this as well. I know that the text, so many of the texts, such as the Isaiah text, speak of prophecy. And when we use the word prophecy in 20th century science, people's eyes glaze over and you know, they look at the eyes look up at the ceiling. They just they don't want to hear that word. But we know that 20th century science takes prophecy very seriously. However, today we do call it remote viewing. And from that perspective, all of this has a tremendous relevance on everything that we're discussing here.
It all does seem to kind of come together. Well, at the bottom of the hour, we were briefly touching on the message now. What would you imagine the message from this glyph to be?
Well, before the station break, when I look at the crop circles, what I mentioned was that I'm looking at three aspects, the mechanism that produced them, where they came from, the source, and then what that message is. This particular glyph, the Arecibo glyph, falls into the category of some of the others. It tells me, they are pointing back to us. They are telling us, the glyph is giving us information about ourselves. And because the DNA is what is changed in the return glyph, and because we know now about this fifth base of DNA that we rarely hear about in college texts and college courses, I certainly wasn't taught about when I was in school, what it's saying is that there is a quality of DNA in our bodies that prevents much of the suffering that we're seeing in our world today. And the experiments that we're going to go through this evening tell us that DNA is directly linked to human emotion by creating very specific qualities of emotion in our bodies.
Perhaps it is, in effect, modulated, I said, by human emotion.
Well, that's what we're precisely what we're finding, directly modulated by human emotion. And this is when we go back into the most sacred texts and the most ancient traditions of our kind, our people who have come before us, they were trying to say something to us. They left massive temples and volumes, entire libraries, in a language of their time, saying that there is a message regarding the wisdom of creation and how we relate to creation. They were attempting to convey that to us. And I think that's what we're finding, whether we're looking at the Isaiah scroll or the Egyptian temple walls or the crop circles in England. Right?
I wonder if they might be talking to us, in effect, messaging us about this, because we are, of course, on the precipice of cloning, as you know. It's
yes.
Underway as we speak, and beginning to tamper with human DNA.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if that has something to do with the timing, because what we found, there is a history of crop circles or crop glyphs appearing in response to human consciousness. For example, in 1991, just outside of the university in Cambridge, England, where Noit Mandelbrot developed the equations for what we call the Mandelbrot set, and the fractal graphics. And the wheat field just outside of his window was the one time that a glyph occurred, and it was undoubtedly the Mandelbrot set glyph.
Mm-hmm.
And researchers had been in the office the night before saying, you know, this crop circle phenomenon, it's interesting, but we can't get our hands around it. If just once we could get a glyph that we could validate mathematically, then we'd have something to talk about. The next morning, the Mandelbrot set is outside the window. Well, I was with Colin Andrews in 1994 in Salisbury at the Crop Circle Conference. We were looking at glyphs from a very ancient Egyptian temple in the Abydos Seti complex. I know you've been there before.
Yes.
It's called the Flower of Life.
That's right.
We were focusing on that glyph, and people asked at the last hour of the conference, wouldn't it be interesting if this appeared somewhere near the conference facility, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, without a shadow of a doubt, the Flower of Life, I mean, it was unmistakable.
Everybody asks, and maybe you have an answer you'd like to, or you'd like to toss something toward this. Everybody asks, why England?
Why England? Well, the truth is that the crop circles have now been registered in every nation on every continent.
Absolutely true.
And the
most complex of them certainly have been in Great Britain.
Precisely. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know why they are focused there. But they are obviously showing up in many different forms and from different media throughout the world. I don't know why so many are showing up in England per se. And what I know is that there are many that show up and are actually mowed under before the public ever has the opportunity to see them.
Very much aware of that. The ones that have showed up elsewhere, particularly in North America, have been like the ones that first showed up in Great Britain. They began very simply and increasingly became more complex,
yes,
as if to teach.
Well, precisely. And again, they seem to fall into categories, Art. It's very interesting. Some of them are biological. Some are mathematical. Some are based on ancient sacred geometric principles. And some are regarding cosmology. Very interesting one, 1993, showed our solar system, a very perfect replica of our solar system, and every planet was in its orbit except for one conspicuous difference, and that was that there was no Earth in the orbit. There was an orbit, and there was no Earth there. Many people interpreted that to say that Earth was going to disappear. And others interpret it to say the Earth as we know it will no longer exist. There's a new Earth emerging, and that certainly falls in line with the ancient texts and the prophecies and the traditions. So I think that out of context, these are strange and mysterious phenomena that really don't have a lot of meaning. Within the context of this time in history, the great change that's been predicted, that science is now seeing, and that the ancient and indigenous peoples allow for in their traditions, it becomes one more phenomenon that asks us to look back at ourselves and our relationship to our world and creation.
Maybe we weren't getting it, Greg. In all the years of these complex, impossibly complex crop circles in Great Britain, I looked at them as a layperson, and I went, oh, my God, like everybody else, that's beautiful. Man could not have done that. I don't believe man did that. But I couldn't get past, that's beautiful, it's symmetrical, it seems like there's something mathematical about it.
Sure.
But maybe we weren't getting it. So what do we have now? We have a face. No question about it. I look at that, Greg, and I see a face.
Well, there's definitely a face there.
And then we have this intricate glyph that seems to be answering our Arecibo message. That I can sink my teeth into.
Well, it's our language. It's our language that we sent to communicate with the cosmos. And what better language to acknowledge that the message was received. And by the way, here are a few little things you might want to look at in your message when it's returned to us.
Well,
now I didn't hear what Richard said in the research that happened through the day today. Did they find any more about the genetics or the actual human form that was shown on?
They're still working on the genetic part of it, to be sure. That's a pretty deep field in itself, so that's going to take a little time.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a feeling that it's going to make sense when we get somebody familiar with the science of genetics to comment. There's going to be something there, I'm almost willing to bet.
Well, one of the great mysteries in the life sciences, and it has been since 1953-54 when Watson and Crick formulated the genetic code, is why so much of human DNA appears to be unused. Of the 64 codes, approximately two-thirds of them appear to be switched off or dormant.
Right.
We only use about a third
of our
genetic code. And when I was in school, I was taught that that code is fixed. And what we now know, Art, is although we only have those 64 possibilities, that within our lifetime, through choices that we make in our lives, we can actually turn those codes off and on the fly. Through choices that we make with an internal technology that I believe the ancients referred to in the language of their time, today we call it thought, feeling, and emotion. And when we turn those codes off and on, what we find, 1998, for example, the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center did a global blood study and found that individuals who had tested positive for the AIDS virus,
yes,
had actually turned on a sets of genes, and they identified University of Alabama, Birmingham, identified five sets of genes that gave these individuals up to 3,000 times greater immune response than we've ever seen before. And what that says is that we, the human race, will not succumb to the HIV virus as predicted back in the early 1980s. We are actually developing a genetic mutation in the same generation where the virus has occurred. It's not in future generations. And when I was in school, I was taught that this kind of thing simply cannot happen.
Is that evolution much better than macro level?
Well, I believe it is. And if we take it one step further, according to the ancient texts, such as we'll get into with the Isaiah text, it can be done intentionally through choices that we make in our lives to think, feel, and emote in specific ways. We actually have the chemical result of that being registered in our bodies. It says that we have an enhanced, tremendously enhanced immune system, that our cells heal faster, up to 100 times faster than what we've seen without these kinds of enhancements. And those codes are enabled where they have been disabled in the same individuals earlier in their lifetime. This is amazing thing to be able to even speak about here this evening. And it points to, or at the beginning of, a very sophisticated internal technology that I believe is referenced many, many different ways in the language of their time and texts that we're seeing 2,000 and 3,000 and 5,000 years ago. Now we're just beginning to make sense of those texts because quantum science has discovered a language.
Well, I understand, and perhaps the audience could best understand if I explain very briefly that there is a signal. Now, if I turn Greg's pot down and I say absolutely nothing for a few seconds, all you will hear is an unmodulated signal. There. That was an unmodulated signal. In other words, you hear nothing. Or if you're listening to AM radio, perhaps you hear a carrier, the carrier of the radio station, that would like to be carrying my modulation because they hate dead air. When I speak, or when Greg speaks, we have modulation. In other words, we have information imparted to this carrier. Is it not possible that our DNA, with this energy we are just discovering, is in effect modulating the energy that we are now just discovering, and that it is having the effect that laid down these patterns in the field, something that I think has to be at least considered?
Well, precisely. Wait until we get into these experiments tonight, Art. They're,
right.
They, in very lay terms, we're going to be describing phenomenon that many people think are mysterious miracles, and they're being documented now in laboratory situations. What it says, the bottom line to all of this, and the ancient many of the ancient texts, the scrolls, the biblical edits that we lost, they're saying that we're directly related to the physical matter of the world around us, and that through emotions in our bodies, we can change the DNA in our bodies, and that DNA is what affects the world around us. It says there's a direct link, and that we are no longer observers, that we are participants in the events that unfold in our lives. And to many people, that's a frightening prospect, and to many others, it's a great relief.
Well, I guess if it were universally realized, we could begin making some, you know, rather positive changes. But if you look at the general situation in the world right now, Greg, and you suggest to yourself that we are doing it,
mm-hmm.
Then we would appear to some to be somewhat suicidal.
Well, I certainly don't suggest we're doing it consciously. What I believe is because we have lost the memory of the capabilities that live within each of us, within every man, woman, and child that's ever walked this earth. There is an internal technology. Religions were built around it, although it's not a religious process. Because we've lost that awareness that the technologies are running rampant, or the chaos is the result of those unrealized potentials. Well, before the evening's over, I'll share with you case histories and global studies that have been done when many people amass in communities and on the global level, coordinated through the World Wide Web.
Yes.
And the effects that we're seeing. I know you've done some of this work on your program as well.
I've done it to the point where it scared the hell out of me and I stopped.
Well, while researchers, because a field of energy is being affected that we are still learning to measure, this nebulous matrix, or what some are calling the quantum or non-local hologram.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're still learning to measure that, we cannot say scientifically that there is a direct cause and effect. What we can do is say that during what the researchers call the prayer window, or the period of time when many people come together, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but
I don't know, Greg. I've seen it rather direct. The experiments I ran, I don't know if you were a listener to the program back when we were doing that.
With the weather patterns.
Oh, my Lord, Greg. We changed the weather in impossible ways. We did a few really impossible things, and, you know, with millions of people participating, I'm aching to try it again, but I'm afraid to try it again.
Well, what has happened, a number of studies were done in the late 70s, early 80s. The Isaiah scroll, and again, we're going to get into this as we go through the evening, the bottom line to the Isaiah scroll, to the one portion that we retranslated and wrote about, Isaiah says to us in the language of his time that there are many possibilities unfolding in every moment of our lives, and that through the feelings in our bodies, we determine which of those plays out in our world. In our local world as well as our global world. And he gives us the instructions. He says, this is how you do it. So through the World Wide Web, listening stations were set up to measure the effects. And during very specific times, the researchers call the window, when people are joined together in this feeling-based technology, what we can say is there's a high correlation.
You found measurable effect.
Measurable effects. Peace treaties were signed. U.S. warplanes turned around.
I'm sure not surprised.
Midair.
When we get back, maybe we can discuss why we are now backing away from peace treaties and putting people who want to put space-based weapons in charge. Listen, stay right there. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell.
The trip back in time continues with Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM. More Somewhere in Time coming up.
Holding you is a warmth that I thought I could never find. Just trying to decide.
Take you back to the past on Art Bell Somewhere in Time.
Well, it makes sense to me. Energy is modulated by our DNA. In other words, the information comes from the DNA. The result in crop fields in England and around the world and a lot of other things, weather changes, things that we've all been able to collectively do. You know, if you're religious, you might want to call it soul power. You can call it anything you want, but that may be how it happens. This energy that we all don't understand, maybe it's really soul energy.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM, from August 24, 2001.
All right, our website is back. I repeat, our website is back. The technicians have reached it, rebooted the servers, and everything appears to be running again. Therefore, if you would like to see Hoagland's analysis of recent crop glyphs, an apparent or possible or alleged answer, if you will, to a broadcast sent out in 1974 by Arecibo, it's up there to be seen. Under What's New, you can look at Hoagland's analysis of recent crop glyphs. Look at where it's located. It'll blow your mind. In addition, you go to program and tonight's guest info, and you look at the newest up there, both by Richard Hoagland. And then if you'll just scroll down a little bit under the name Greg Braden, you'll see photos for tonight's discussion, and you're going to want to click on that, too, because that's where we're going. When we, at the top of the hour, when we stopped, we were talking about documented results of using this energy that may be modulated, in effect, by our DNA into the collective consciousness. And you were saying there are documented results. Can you get specific, Greg?
Well, there certainly are, and we break these down into categories. There are documented results for personal effects, where we can actually, through the magic of ultrasound, see physiological changes inside of a human body within 3 to 4 minutes in the presence very specific kinds, qualities of human emotion. That's for individuals. And then on the global level, on the mass level,
mm-hmm.
when many people come together in moments of shared emotion, very specific qualities of emotion, and we're going to find those in just a moment, what we can see is that in large population centers, traffic accidents decline, emergency room visits in hospitals decline, violent crimes against people decline, the stock market soars. During what researchers call the window, when these effects are being created and when the window closes, when the effects stop, when people stop doing these things, those numbers reverse. 1998, we had the opportunity through the World Wide Web to set up a special program, an experimental program. It was actually called The Great Experiment, and we did three versions of it between 1998 and the year 2001. And what happened was, in 98, 84 nations, several hundred thousand people, participated in a collective time of peace. And the secret, the key to this internal technology, to this lost mode of prayer that's described in some of the Dead Sea Scrolls, some of our most ancient texts, is that this inner technology, it has no outer expression. There are no words to this modality of prayer. It simply is a feeling, and it's feeling the feeling as if the prayer has already been answered, rather than asking for intervention and asking that the prayer, the answer to the prayer, come to pass.
Well, you know, a lot of people in the modern world, Greg, would say, oh, come on, this is really touchy-feely stuff. And,
well, sure.
And you know, they would say that because in the modern world, we're really not all that touchy-feely at all. We're very materialistic, and so these things have been absent to a large degree, except among very small groups, for such a long time that, of course, people would think that.
Well, precisely, Art. Maybe what, you know, the best thing to do, the first hour, we covered a lot of ground. Maybe what I'd like to do is just go back, build a little foundation of where all this comes from, so that we can tie back into this for the next three or four hours, however long that we're going.
Sure.
Because many of my colleagues in the industry, I come from the world of science, aerospace and Earth and space and ocean sciences, and they say, well, how come we've never heard of any of this? If this form of energy exists, and if we have access to our world through this form of energy, why don't we know about it? That's a very good question. And what we know, this could be a whole program unto itself, obviously, is that tremendous amounts of information have been lost to the West since the year 48 B.C. In the year 48 B.C., we know that what was known as the Great Library of Alexandria burned to the ground during a civil war, and Roman historians, before it was destroyed, cataloged, Art, over 532,000 scrolls. Many of the scrolls had multiple authors and held what the ancient Hebraic, Babylonian, Sumerian, Egyptian, and Greek scholars considered to be the great secrets of creation. Well, almost universally, ancient texts say there was a time in the history of our world when this is their words, these aren't my words, they say when the wisdom of the heavens was given to the people of our world, and the scholars say this is what was contained in these texts. So we lost a lot during the great library of Alexandria, the loss of that library. And during the biblical edits of the 4th century, we know at least 45 texts, 45 books, were either completely deleted or condensed, rearranged, and edited to become what we now know as our Western biblical text.
Now, one might ask, though, Greg, if the ancients had this knowledge,
mm-hmm.
which translates to power, power to change, right?
Certainly.
Change things in the world, if not the universe as we know it, then how come they're gone and their text is dust and we're here?
Well, what apparently began to happen was as those who were, when the information was given to the people of this world, it was given in the language of another time. And over time, that language began to make less and less sense to all but a small group of people, apparently. They became what we know as elite priesthoods and mystery schools. And in the language of their time, they did their best to preserve this kind of wisdom. We know about it. because we're rediscovering many of those texts in the vaults of the Vatican Library, for example, in the private libraries of the Habsburgs and in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that, again, I mean, that could be a whole program unto itself. But that brings us fast forward to the Dead Sea Scrolls. First discovered, the first scrolls were found in 1946. They were announced in 1947. Between 46 and 56, over 225,000 fragments of papyrus and copper and animal hide were pieced together, and they became eventually about 850 scrolls. Of those, only one was found completely intact. And that one scroll is believed to be so precious by scholars today, it's not even about dollars. It's so precious that it is displayed, it's 22 feet long, and it's unrolled on a cylinder that is designed to retract into a concrete and steel-reinforced vault under the floor with steel doors to cover and protect it in the event of a natural disaster or a nuclear attack on Israel. And we must ask, what could possibly warrant
so
that kind of protection for this scroll? That
I'm
one
asking.
Scroll, it's the Great Isaiah Scroll.
I'm asking.
Well, what we're saying, everything we're about to do this evening is contained, references are contained in that Great Isaiah Scroll. What Isaiah is saying to us in the language of his time that was given to him from a previous time is that within every moment of our lives there are many worlds that exist. We touch those worlds through the language of emotion in our bodies. When we feel the feeling in our bodies, the feeling is what awakens that possibility, that quantum possibility, and brings it to bear upon our lives. And now quantum science is saying precisely the same thing through the language of Dr. Hugh Everett III from Princeton University, who formulated in 1957 the parallel worlds possibilities. And Michio Kaku is talking about the 10 and 11 dimensions.
That's right.
Of the superstring theory. Emotion, human emotion, is the language that speaks to the forces of creation and awakens those possibilities, and that's what was edited and lost in the biblical text. In the 4th century, when we lost that, and you're precisely correct, Art, we became a very logic-based, non-touchy-feely, male-dominated, schematically-oriented society, and it has served us very well. It's brought us to the point where now we must come to terms with the rest of the picture to survive.
We're mostly hardware guys.
Well, and what some of the greatest minds of our time are saying, and what the ancients said, is that it is that very technology that will turn around and bite us, that our technology will bring us to a point and it will fail us. And when it fails us, if we have not recognized the internal technology, the honoring of the life and our relationship to the world around us, that may be the end of this cycle.
And so, us.
Pardon me?
And us.
And us. And that is only one possibility that is referenced. And at the same time, many of the greatest prophets, Nostradamus, Edgar Cayce, Isaiah, the first Old Testament prophet, he also said, he foresaw another time when that never happened. He said, I see a time when the disease is gone, when war isn't even written in the books any longer, when the deaf hear and the blind see, and the weather of the earth is gentle and crops grow in their season.
Mm.
And he said, both of them are possible. Here's how you determine which of those become your reality. Now the language of quantum physics has become the bridge that allows us to make sense of what he said, and that's the foundation of everything we're doing tonight. I'd like to...
All right, well, while technology is on our side and the website is up, you have put up images tonight.
All right.
And I'm looking at one of them, and if I had not gone up and looked at the word fetus, for example, above the first photograph that you've got here, everybody can get to that by going to my website, artbell.com.
Okay, well, we're going to have to set this image up a little bit.
Okay, we shall give people time to get there. Program, tonight's guest info, under the name Greg Braden, you'll see the images for tonight. Click on that and join us. I would not have known that was a fetus, so go ahead and set it up.
Well, okay, we haven't talked about the three experiments yet, so now that you've brought this up, we'll go through this, and we're going to go back and talk about the three experiments and tie these in.
Good. Let's do it.
Quantum physics is saying now, and many ancient traditions say, there's a field of energy that, a web, if you will, or a matrix that links every particle of creation in ways that we're only beginning to understand. One of the early, very well-known researchers that began, that took this one step further, rather than theorizing, actually began working with this, was a gentleman, a British engineer during World War II. His name was George Delawarre. And you may be familiar, maybe some of your guests have referenced him on the show before. His job, he had a great job description, in World War II. His job was to find the energy matrix that is responsible for the human mind, because the thinking was that that military secrets were leaking through this energy matrix, and his job was to work with that. So to make a long story very brief, he created a machine that, once given the sample of any physical, any living system in the world, if he had a little piece of it, by virtue of the holographic principle, he could reproduce the entire image no matter where he was in the world. One of the first experiments he did, he produced over 400 photographs in a hospital in late 40s, early 50s. The image that you're seeing, and I don't have this in front of me on the machine, so I'm assuming it's the first image up there.
That's right.
He was in England, in the hospital in England. A woman in the States was pregnant. She didn't know how far along she was. She sent a droplet of her blood, and that's all that was sent to him in England. He used his machine to tune to the field of energy that surrounds every living system and photographed what he found in that field. He could have tuned to her body. However, he knew that she was pregnant, so he tuned to the fetus and where he would have the clearest image of the fetus.
From a drop of blood?
From a single drop of blood. So what you're seeing is not an X-ray.
Oh, my.
It is a photograph of an energetic imprint in London from a woman in the States that is derived from a droplet of blood.
Oh, my God. Tell me about this machine a little bit. What was this machine?
Well, it's all based on very fundamental principles that we know as radionics, psychotronics, that are tuning into what we call the quantum hologram. Now, one of the things, when we show this on the big screen in our workshops, one of the things that is conspicuously absent in this image, and it's upside down the way it was scanned, and I apologize for that.
Oh, okay, I've suddenly got it upside down.
If you can reverse it, one of the things that's conspicuously missing, Art, is the umbilical cord.
Yes.
That you would expect to see on a fetus. However, if you will look at the back of the crown on the top of the head, what you see is, and that's as far as the machine would take it, you see the equivalent of an umbilical cord coming from the top of the head.
Remember, I see it.
This is not a physical image. This is an energetic image. And throughout the ancient texts, we're told again and again that our energetic umbilical cord is through the crown chakra of the body. And this may be one of the first images that we have that actually shows the umbilical, the crown umbilical, coming from just to the back. If you find the top center of the head.
Oh, no, I see it. I see it clearly. Once you understand the image is upside down,
there's
problem.
Something else very interesting in that image, and again, I don't have it in front of me, but if you look, it appears to have scratches.
Yes.
Different portions of it.
Yes.
I'm working with a researcher, a shroud researcher. Her name is Sue Benford, and some of her work is credited and linked on our websites as well. I was speaking with her about those marks, and the physicists that she's worked with have had the opportunity to see these, said they are definitely not scratches, and they suspect that they may actually be particles, what they were calling tachyon particles, that were moving through that energetic field when the image was created. Now, again, this is not a photograph. It's not an X-ray.
No, this was derived from one drop of blood supplied by a pregnant woman in America, and the picture of the fetus was then taken from that with his machine in Great Britain.
Because, in the holographic principle, when you have a portion of the whole physically, the energetic blueprint of the whole exists in its entirety. So if you've got a piece of it, you've got the whole thing through the holographic principle. Now, where this gets really interesting is if this were a fake, if it were painted, if it were simply an X-ray, even in an X-ray art, information is truncated. When we X-ray bones, they appear flattened or distorted sometimes.
That's right.
Okay. NASA has a device called a Victor VP8 analyzer. And this is the machine that takes the two-dimensional images from the satellites, the Viking images of Mars, or the satellites of the Magellan that went to Venus. It renders them in three dimensions and makes them look very alive,
mm-hmm.
because they are. And if they were simply painted images, it would not happen. Well, the next image that you're going to see when you scroll down, they took George Delawar's two-dimensional image, Sue Benford did this, ran it through the NASA VP8 analyzer, and that is the way that the VP8 analyzer renders that fetus. And what you can see is it is very three-dimensional. The information is not truncated. It is not hoaxed. It's not painted. It's not an X-ray. There is so much information contained. Even the traces of the subatomic particles that look like scratches are rendered in that three dimension.
They sure are. Oh, my. Hold
there's
on.
More. There's more. There's more.
I'm sure there is. Hold it right there. Try and imagine that. One drop of a woman's blood, a pregnant woman, analyzed in Europe, produces a picture of the fetus the woman is carrying. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM. We're calling this the Isaiah Effect.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24, 2001. Premier Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24th, 2001.
This has merit. It says, it's a fax that just arrived. It says, hi Art and Greg. There is no question that group consciousness with prayer, or what I call willful intent, not only saved my life, but also allowed me to enter a parallel universe. I'm very grateful and hope you both continue this type of research. By the way, I think the work of the German scientist Max Planck proved that we have come nowhere near understanding the quantum nature of ourselves and the universe in the 101 years since he put forth his theory of quantum physics. I thoroughly support the work that Greg is doing and have a first-hand understanding that it is true. Signed, with purpose, Danion Brinkley.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24, 2001.
All right, once again, here's Greg Braden. Greg, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be back, Art. Before we go any further, I'd just like to take a moment and acknowledge Danyon's fax and thank him for listening tonight. I know how busy he is, and it means a lot that he took a moment to send that fax to us.
Well, he was the recipient of one of the experiments when I was still doing them.
That's right. I remember that very well. Well, the information that we shared just before the break is just one little piece of a research project. And the listeners, if they're interested in seeing that entire project, it's published in the Journal of Theoretics, and we do have a hot link to that entire article on our website. So when we give out the website, they can look for that hot link, and the researcher is Mary Sue Benford, Benford.
I think we've got a link to your website up there also.
Okay. So what we did just before the break, as amazing as it sounds, it falls well within the bounds of what we would expect to find the kinds of effects we would see if there is this all-pervading field of energy, this holographic field, or the quantum hologram, as many researchers are now calling it, that links us in ways and in realms on a non-physical level that we're only beginning to understand.
I.e., everything is a collective.
Well, it is, and now I'm a little disadvantaged, Art, because I do not have the images in front of me, and I'm assuming they were placed on the website in the order that I sent them to the webmaster.
All right, the third picture down, I can only tell you, as I look at it, by Sue Benford, resembles a sort of a mountain with trees.
Mountain with trees. There should be an image there that is the stomach of a cow, bovine stomach.
A bovine stomach. Okay, let me see. Yes, okay, I've got it. Bovine stomach. I've
okay.
got it. Yes.
Well, this is from the same period of time from George Delaware. He was working with his machine at the hospital in London. A veterinarian in the States had a cow that was it was ill. He couldn't tell what was wrong with it. He'd heard about Delaware's work, and he said, let's try it. So he sent a drop of the blood from the cow to George Delaware, and again, Delaware could tune to various fields from that drop of blood. He had a way of tuning. It's through resonance, and he could tune to specific organs or general views, and he focused on the stomach of the cow. And the image that you see, it is not an X-ray. It is a photograph of the energetic blueprint of the stomach of that particular cow. Like the previous image was not an X-ray, it was the energetic blueprint of the fetus, and living fetus inside the woman.
Yes.
So what you're seeing there, obviously something is happening there. When you go down the next image, what is the next image showing?
This was the fourth image, by the way, not the third. The next image, a rendering again of bovine stomach.
Okay, through the VP8 analyzer?
Yes, VP8.
Okay, so this is the same thing then. Researchers, Sue Benford and the researchers, took Delaware's two-dimensional image, put it through the NASA's VP8 analyzer. This is the three-dimensional rendering.
Ah.
And you can tell, I mean, obviously there's a tremendous amount of information. It's not truncated the way you would see, expect to see an X-ray or something like that. And you can almost make out the outline of objects in the stomach. And once we see those objects, you can tell very clearly what they are. Should be the next image down. They operated based on this information. Delaware sent it back to the veterinarian.
Oh, my goodness.
They operated on the cow.
On the cow. And took them out.
They took them out. And the cow lived. It was it actually saved the life of the cow. And for listeners that do not have this on their screen, what the image, what you're seeing, is a piece of wire and a stone. And the wire is what makes the two humps that we're seeing. The wire is bent is two humps, like an elongated letter M.
I've got it. So the stupid cow ate some wire and a rock.
Well, that's what
it boils down to, right?
That's what happened.
But that was picked up using nothing more than one drop of blood.
Of blood.
From the cow. That's just so impossible.
Well, this ties into some of the experiments we're going to talk about in a little while. What we found, what the experiments are showing, is that even when tissue is separated from a living donor by as much as 50 miles, that the tissue and the donor are still energetically linked, and we'll talk about
wow.
those in just a minute.
All right.
So these are the Delaware images, and the entire report is up there in the Journal of Theoretics. Now, we did this, Art, within just an hour or so of the program tonight. So it was done very quickly, and I apologize for, if they didn't come out as well as we'd like them or the fetus was inverted. But
no, that's quite all right.
I thought it was important. I really wanted the viewers to be able to see some of these images because what it is, it's saying that we've known, at least since the late 1800s when the principles were developed, in the 1940s when the machines were built, that there is this web or this all-pervading field of energy that links us in ways, now that we're only beginning to understand, the machines are showing that. The ancient traditions say we don't need the machines, that there's something we can do in our lives that utilizes this field of energy and produces effects in our bodies and in the world around our bodies.
No, this is just good proof for the hardware kind of people that we are right now, that's all.
Well, sure, sure. That's precisely what these images are showing. Now, before we go to the other images on the website, I'd like to share three experiments, or at least begin them before the top of the hour, and then maybe...
No, go right ahead.
We'll go through them on the other side of the hour. And there are certainly other experiments that have been done, but these are three very poignantly describe this field of energy. The first one was done by a Russian physicist in 1991. His name is Vladimir Popanin, and on the website, I've put both his unpublished lab notes as well as the link to the replicated experiments so people can see what he did. And essentially, what he did was he took a glass tube, took all the air out of it, and created what we call a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Although we know even in a vacuum, there's still something there.
Sure.
Light particles are called photons.
Right.
And they said even in a vacuum, photons are still there. Let's measure them and see what their distribution is. So they want to see if they were scattered or if they were random or aligned or whatever. And just as they expected, in the vacuum, the photons were completely random. That's precisely what they expected. Then, and I really, really honor their vision for doing, for even thinking about this kind of an experiment, they placed some human DNA into the vacuum.
Really?
And they said, now what effect does human DNA have on the physical molecule of DNA on the non-physical particles of light, on the photons?
Right.
They measured them again, and to their amazement, the photons were no longer random. They lined up and were aligned
By the DNA?
Following the pattern of DNA. The physical DNA had an effect.
Holy smokes.
On the light. Our world is made of light. And this was the beginning of this experiment. Now, where it gets really interesting, they took the DNA out of the vacuum, and they said, let's see what the pattern of light looks like now. And to their amazement, the photons were still aligned as if the DNA were there, although it was no longer physically in the tube.
Oh, my gosh.
And they're saying, why? What could possibly...
Or how?
...be in place? How are these photons of light still connected to this physical DNA? This experiment was called the DNA phantom effect, is what it's called. It's been replicated several times. And what they're showing from this is that there is a field of energy that we haven't recognized in the past, previously unrecognized form of energy, and that the physical molecule of DNA is affecting non-physical matter, light, through this...
Maybe a good parallel would be a permanent magnet. If you get a nail near a permanent magnet and stroke it a few times,
right.
Take the permanent magnet away and the nail remains magnetized.
Through a force, and we're saying why? Because the magnet's no longer there.
That's right. Well, I was just trying to come up with a parallel.
Well, that would be an analogy. There is obviously something going on in the nail that we understand. But with the DNA, now for them to even think... to even suspect that physical DNA would have an effect on the non-physical matter.
Well, it documents the force that we're trying to talk about here.
Well, this is the first experiment. The second one, Art, I think you're going to find really interesting. It was conducted by the U.S. Army in 1993. It was Intelligence and Security Command. 1993, and what they did was they took human DNA from a donor. They actually scraped tissue from the inside of the mouth of the donor.
Yes.
Of the donors, leukocytes, white blood cells, is what they had. And this is a very interesting experiment. In the same building, so this is happening in the same building, they placed the donor in one room of the building, and the donor's DNA in a very sensitive machine in another room of the same building.
Yes.
And what they did was they exposed the donor to very powerful emotional stimulus caused from video clips. So they were very graphic wartime clips, erotic clips, humorous clips, inducing very powerful states of emotion in the donor in one room. And they said, let's see if his DNA is affected in any way in another room.
Let me guess. The DNA started to jump around.
Well, what they found was that the DNA, electrically, when the donor had a peak or a valley experience, the DNA in another room was experiencing the same thing. What makes this interesting is when we think about energy, typically we think about energy being generated in one place and broadcast or transmitted somewhere else, and that takes time.
Right.
There was no lag time between the time the donor had his experience and the DNA had its response. So then they separated. They began separating the donor and the DNA. They said, how far can we separate them and have this effect still in place? And they stopped the experiment when the donor and his DNA were 50 miles apart, and there was no lag time.
I don't think, had they gone to Australia, there would have been any difference.
Well,
if it's operating in the same non-local area as remote viewing,
well, precisely.
There's no difference.
Well, precisely, and obviously, this is just another way of researchers recognizing that there this form of energy exists. What was interesting is the effect is not between the donor and his DNA. It is not bound by physical distance or time. And what they're actually saying is that human emotion is generating an effect, working in a field that transcends time and distance. Human emotion is doing this with the physical DNA. But think of the implications of organ transplants.
Well, of course, we've already seen indications in organ transplants that information, impossible information, is imparted to the recipients of the organs of the donor.
Well, it is. And what does it mean for clones? And this is what's pushing the researchers. I think these kinds of questions are pushing the researchers scientifically. Now, we must determine and find a way to define what we call consciousness, what we call mind, what we call the soul, and what we call collective intelligence and the collective consciousness. And the questions come up, you know, if we create a human clone, does it have a soul? And how does that soul relate to the soul of the original being or the original cell? So these are all, this is just the second experiment. The third experiment, let's do all three of them, then we'll find together. The third one, the Institute of Heart Math in Boulder Creek, California, I've worked with very closely since 91. And they are, for listeners that may not be familiar, they are pioneers in innovative heart-based technologies. And that's probably the best way for me to describe what they're doing. One of the discoveries they made back in the early 90s was that every human heart is surrounded by a donut-shaped electromagnetic field between 5 and 8 feet in diameter. And that's only as far as the machines could measure. They think it probably extends miles on the quantum level, but the machines could only measure 5 to 8 feet.
Wow.
So this is an electrum. It's not the aura or the prana. This is a measurable electromagnetic field in the shape of a tube torus or a donut. And they know this. This is acknowledged. It's been published in JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association, New Scientist. This is acknowledged. The question was, within that field, is there an additional form of energy that we haven't recognized generated by the human heart? Is there a non-Hertzian field, a field that works beyond the bounds of our Hertz-based technology? What they did, this is, again, probably no surprise, they took some human DNA from placentas because placental DNA is a very pristine form of DNA,
mm-hmm.
and this ties back into the crop glyph that we've just seen. Before the DNA goes through the experience of life, it is a very pristine form. And what they did was they had researchers trained in what is called emotional self-management. They could, on demand, create rage or compassion, joy or anger, through techniques that are very widely used and taught throughout their industry now. And they had them place this placental DNA in glass vials in the hands of these individuals,
mm-hmm.
and they asked them to have very specific forms of emotion. And to make a long story very brief, Art, what they found was that human emotion repeatedly, predictably, and consistently actually changed the shape, the physical shape, the winding of the way the two strands of the DNA were put together.
Uh-huh.
And what they found was that, and in the English language, I'm going to use words like gratitude, compassion, love, understanding, appreciation. In other cultures, it doesn't work the same. But in English, those are the words that most closely approximate the kind of emotion that we're talking about here. Those emotions relaxed the DNA to the point that the two strands were actually physically separate from one another. They were no longer intertwined. Rage, jealousy, anger, frustration wound up that DNA so tight, it was like a little knot. And this is important because we just touched on this earlier. The codes that are turned off and turned on in our genetic code appear to be linked to the way the DNA is twisted in our cell. So certain forms of emotion appear to turn on the codes of immune, tremendously enhanced immune systems and healing abilities through love, compassion, understanding,
mm-hmm.
forgiveness. Others actually deplete those qualities, actually turn those codes or inhibit those codes by having the DNA so knotted up. Now, and there are other experiments, but these three, what they're saying is
very compelling. Oh, very compelling.
What they're saying is, the first one, saying that human DNA has a direct effect on the physical world around us, on those photons, which is the basic constituent of everything in our world. Everything's made out of light, of photons. The second experiment is showing that it's not related by time and distance, and that human emotion talks right. to the DNA.
Right.
And this now, through the language of 21st century science, is shedding new light on what so many of the ancient texts and traditions have tried to say in the language of their time. They said, when you become these things in your body, this is what you can expect. This is the healing you can expect. This is the peace you can expect in your world. And it is through these kinds of experiments that the Isaiah scroll is taking on new meaning.
All right. When we get back then, if you then take this, what should be pristine DNA, and you make it not so pristine by cloning, then really it is a good question about whether what results, what you have birthed, or if you will, what you have created, will have a soul. Will it have a soul? Will it have a pristine soul? Will it have a soul of its own? Will it have any soul at all? We're about to go where perhaps we ought not be going. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Stay right there.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24, 2001.
You shouldn't worry, I said that ain't no crime. Drifting on the sea of heartbreak, trying to get myself ashore for so long, for so long. Listening to the strangest stories, wondering where it all went.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24, 2001.
If you've been intrigued by what you're hearing tonight, and I don't know how you cannot be if you've been listening carefully, then you might want to read Greg Braden's The Isaiah Effect. Obviously, if you go to my website, you'll have a route to get to that book at Amazon.com or anywhere else. It's called The Isaiah Effect. That's what we've been talking about tonight. My guest is Greg Braden, and we'll get right back to him. Stay right where you are.
Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
We are obviously either about to clone or we are cloning now as we speak. Now, in my mind, that means we take DNA that is not pristine, as we have recently discussed with Greg, and we grow a duplicate from that DNA. And so that may be why all the people are asking, well, then, will the clone, in essence, have a soul? If the soul is collectively attached or part of the DNA, which seems probable based on what we've heard tonight, this collectiveness, this oneness that allows any image to be retrieved from nothing more than a drop of blood, then what about when we clone, Greg?
Well, we now have the foundation, and the little bit we've done tonight, we've got the vocabulary, we can begin answering, or at least speculating about precisely those kinds of questions, Art. If the quality of the DNA, if the soul is information, which is essentially what we're saying here,
right?
And it is, we are linked to those fields of information through the circuits of our genetic code, of our DNA, the quality of our DNA plays a significant role in the quality of our soul. So what we're finding is it's the pristine form found in the placental DNA that the researchers use. That would be a very different quality of DNA, and I'm speculating here because we don't know the answer, but presumably a different quality of soul than taking and cloning from a cell of an individual who, through 50 or 60 or 80 years of experience, has made choices in their lives that have changed that DNA.
Yes.
And this, I think, takes us back to where we began just a couple of hours ago with this glyph, the Arecibo glyph. I looked at this again over the break at the top of the hour.
Yes.
And I'm looking at a low-resolution image, and you probably have a much better image there than I do, and my computer is not up in front of me right now. The more I look at this, the glyph that came, the return glyph in the crop, the humanoid figure,
yes,
to me appears to be embryonic, human embryonic, rather than ET or off-planet, just because of the proportions that we're looking at. And when you look above it, obviously the two strands of DNA are not mirror images of one another.
Correct.
And it is that non-mirroring. And if I had a higher resolution, in the center, just above the head of the human, are, according to the schematic, are the nucleotides of the DNA.
Right.
I would be willing to bet, on a higher resolution image, the ones that came back to us, if there are changes, the changes are going to be in that cytosine, which is the fifth base that we don't hear about so often, that we find up to 6% of in at birth. And then as we begin to lose that, that's when we begin to go into the aging process and the breakdown of the bodily functions. So this message may be saying we've got everything we need the moment we come into this world. And again, it's asking us to look back at ourselves again, as so many other glyphs have.
All right. Carol in Council Bluffs, Iowa, I'm looking at my computer, asks, does all this have implications for the underlying laws of magic and how feng shui works. You are, in other words, attached to all your possessions by energy.
This couldn't have been a better question for what I wanted to do next, before we go into the next part of our discussion. To answer that question, I'm going to say, just add one more thing. Modern science, of the many theories that scientists in different, across the board do not agree upon, there is now a theory that most scientists in the many different branches of science do agree upon, and that is that everything we know in our world, all that we can touch, see, feel, hear, taste, experience, is what it is because of four forces of nature. And those four forces are the electromagnetic force, the force of gravity, what are called the strong and the weak nuclear forces. Without going into a lot more detail, we could tonight, what it looks like is happening, Art, is the experiments are showing us that we have direct access to the four fundamental forces of nature through our bodies. The experimental evidence is showing, right now, we know at least 75%. We know that electromagnetic force, the weak nuclear force, and gravity are directly related to human emotion. In other words, by changing human emotion, we can shift the effects of those forces. And I suspect that if we were to have this interview a year from now, I would say that 100% of those are linked to us. I think this is the great message in the most sacred of our texts. It says that when we become a certain quality of emotion in our bodies, that we are no longer simply observers of the events of the world around us and what happens in our bodies, that we are participants. We are co-creating the health in our bodies and the events in our world. This then ties into the question from the listener.
All right.
I believe the answer is yes. I think all of this, the implications are what we've always thought was magic, was our ability to interact with the forces of nature.
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Here's another good leap that makes some sense to me. It's from Janelle in Vancouver, Washington. We've been pondering for a long, long time, what in the world is a ghost? Is a ghost the remaining soul of a person here on Earth? We've certainly documented that ghosts seem to exist. Or is it some sort of a weird, repeating, tape loop-like echo of what once was here? Janelle in Vancouver asks, could ghosts really be the residual images of DNA left behind on walls, floors, property?
Well, it's a good question, and once again, this is where quantum science, and within the last 5 years, is building a vocabulary bridging ancient spiritual and religious traditions with Western science right now.
Mm-hmm.
Quantum science, the great mystery has been to unify those four forces of nature. In our third-dimensional world, it's very difficult, very complex to do. What the researchers have found, scientists have found, is that the higher we go in the dimensions, the more dimensions we add, the simpler the mathematics becomes, until it appears there is a single force at work higher in the dimensions that becomes four separate forces in the third-dimensional world. So the string theory and superstring theories and quantum hologram now say that we exist in a world of at least 10 dimensions and that we are present in every one of those dimensions, although maybe not conscious in every one of those dimensions. So that implies that in the dimensions above our third-dimensional world that we have etheric blueprints that we could call the ghost, I think a blueprint is probably the best word we can use at this point in the program, and rather than residuals of DNA, that the what we...
Well, I mean, we know that, we know energy does not simply cease to exist, as certainly any of the energy that we measure. And so then if we imagine there is this energy you speak of that we've not really quantified yet, which is emitted or modulated by DNA, then does it not make sense that when our physical lives end, this energy in some way is residual and certainly remains?
Not necessarily residual. It simply continues.
Continues, yes.
It no longer has the physical expression. And the field of energy, just to give it a name, so that listeners, if they'd like to go do more research on this, it's now being called non-local energy. That's the big buzzword in physics now.
Non-local energy.
Or the non-local quantum hologram.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo astronaut, I just had the honor of sharing the stage with him at a conference last weekend. This is the thrust of his work. We've got hot links to his website. Michio Kaku, the superstring theorist from Columbia University, one of the leading theorists developing the superstring theories. I'm not saying that they're agreeing with everything we say here tonight, and they are laying down the foundation for the physics that allows for the kinds of things that that we're speaking about here this evening.
All right. Somebody wanted you to comment on something we did skip, and that was the shroud face picture.
Well, that's where we're getting back to this. As I mentioned just a few moments ago, science agrees there are four forces, fundamental forces in nature. And I believe now that we understand this, when we reread some of our most sacred texts in the language of their time, they were trying to say to us that we are directly tied to those forces and the world around us, that we are not at the whim of creation. I've worked very closely with shroud researchers for most of my adult life. And what I believe that shroud, first of all, I'll say we may never know precisely who the man in the shroud was. Science has no test to tell us who a man is. What I believe that shroud is saying to us, I believe that the man in that shroud left a mystery. And he said, through his mystery, he said, the only way you're going to understand what this shroud means is to understand how you relate to creation. Because what it appears is happening now is there are quantum implications of the image on that are on that shroud. In other words, the man in the shroud accessed the four forces of nature
in order to create that imprint,
and brought them to bear in that moment in order to create the imprint. And that's the only way that quantum science right now can explain what's happening in the shroud. And by the way, quantum scientists understand many of the principles we're speaking about tonight, and they believe, this is the crux of the great argument, they believe that the principles we're speaking about apply only to the quantum world, and they're having difficulty relating them to the macro world, to the big world around us. And there are other researchers, the cover of the Discover magazine, I just saw in the airport last week, actually has an article about the greatest secret in physics, speaking about precisely these theories, and talks about scientists who are saying, in fact, what we see in the quantum world does apply to the world around us.
Greg, if we were able to get a sample of Christ's blood,
yes,
do you believe that when the DNA was examined, it would have subtle or not so subtle differences?
I believe that it would, Art, and we're actually, I've worked with shroud researchers, I've asked this very question, and the question comes up even taking it one step further, what if it were cloned? What if that DNA were cloned?
Well, that would, of course, require an intact sample of that blood with
precisely
recoverable DNA, but, you know, Christ performed miracles that we would regard as magic or divinely inspired or, you know, however you want to put it.
Unless we understood that we had access to the four forces of creation.
Yes.
So what is what I'm showing on that image? I think is it image number three? Then is that the one that looked like a bunch of trees to you?
Yes. It kind of looked like a mountainside and trees.
Okay. What this is, now that we've spoken about NASA's VP8 analyzer, and we've talked about if an image is hoaxed. If it were painted or drawn in two dimensions,
mm-hmm.
If the images from George Delaware's machine had been hoaxed or just simply photographs, we ran them through the analyzer, they would appear out of shape and very distorted. The information would be truncated. The same researchers that worked with Delaware's work, primarily M. Sue Benford and Joseph Marino, a colleague of hers, took the principles from Delaware's work and said, what would happen if we were to run the image of the face of the Shroud of Turin through the VP8 analyzer?
Right.
And the image you're looking at is the result of that that experiment. And what it's showing very clearly is that the image is not truncated, that there's a tremendous amount of information that is contained in that shroud. It could not be painted. It could not be hoaxed. It's not body oils. And very interesting, the scientists I'm working with right now, and from the 1978 Shroud of Turin research project, that's a stroke study, are saying that they're, rather than saying what the shroud is, what they're saying right now is that there is no scientific evidence that prevents the shroud from being authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And the dating fiasco, I think, is that's a subject of an entirely different program, but we know that there were tremendous errors in the dating process, and I believe that shroud will probably be redated sometime in the next year or so. I think the church will allow that. But what that image is showing that there are quantum implications and holographic principles that are embodied in the face of the image of the shroud, and there are other images where the entire body art has been run through the VP8 analyzer. So we know a tremendous amount about the man in the shroud from this VP8 analyzer. We know he was 5 feet 11 inches tall. He weighed about 178 pounds. There's a tremendous amount of blood on the shroud. It's human. It's type AB positive. And from that, we can infer just tremendous amounts of information about the man in the shroud. And
just to nail this down so I know, no pun intended, that blood is not got recoverable DNA, does it?
It has fragmented DNA.
Right.
And in 1978, the way the blood was lifted from the shroud, the DNA, the science of DNA was not very advanced in 1978, DNA forensics analysis.
Right.
They were not taking the blood for the purpose of DNA analysis, so they had sticky tape, and they took random samples. Next time, in the event there is a next time that they go back and they're allowed to do this, they will know better very specific places on the shroud to go and to recover perhaps more intact portions of the blood. But that image that you're looking at, it's just an amazing, it's an unbelievable image showing the true holographic three-dimensional nature of that image on the shroud. Even the creases in the linen are showing it in that three-dimensional nature. And that simply could not happen through anything other than a natural process. It can't happen through a painting or, if someone were burning it onto the shroud through a heated statue or body oils or anointing oils or something like that.
Huh.
So the shroud, the message of the shroud may be less about who the man was, and he may have been saying, the only way to understand the mystery I leave to you is for you to understand who you are, people of my future, and how you relate to the forces of creation, and then you will know yourself.
Is it not possible, then, that this glyph, this answer to the Arecibo message that everybody's so excited about right now, is suggesting to us the manner in which DNA might be changed, or once was, I have no way of knowing which would approximate... if we could achieve it, if we could achieve it, I'll say, that would, in effect, make us gods supermen.
What it's saying, I mean, to use the language and the terminology of our program here tonight and of your program with Richard last night, I think what it's saying, Art, is that it's showing us the time in our lives when we are most complete, when we are closer to that pristine form than we are at any other time. And I believe that may be why the body is depicted the way it's depicted, why the twin strands of DNA are not mirror images of one another.
So it makes sense to you?
It makes tremendous sense. And when we look at it within the context, again, if this were just something that happened in the middle of a normal day, it would be a very bizarre phenomenon. Within the context of this time in history and past glyphs, it takes on, I think, a very relevant meaning.
Greg, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. We may try and fit a few phone calls in here. Greg Braden is my guest. His book is The Isaiah Effect. Are you beginning to get the idea? I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
This is Premier Networks. That was Art Bell hosting Coast to Coast AM on this Somewhere in Time.
anybody else would surely know.
What a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright, blessed day, the dark, sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry.
Somewhere in Time with Art Bell continues, courtesy of Premier Networks.
Somehow fits to this topic quite well, doesn't it? Attaches itself. Good morning, I'm Art Bell. Greg Braden is my guest. He's author of The Isaiah Effect, and if you've been listening by now, I think you understand what The Isaiah Effect is. It kind of makes sense, doesn't it?
What a wonderful.
It is. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from August 24, 2001.
Once again, back to Greg Braden, author of The Isaiah Effect, a book you can pick up and should, obviously, to read about what you've been hearing about this morning. Greg, we've got a lot of callers on the line. I'd like to get to a few of them if we could.
Art, before we do that, can I just wrap up a little bit on what Isaiah was saying in the scrolls, and then I think we're going to tie into that through the questions, probably.
All right, go.
So essentially what this 2,500-year-old text is saying is what we have discussed here tonight in the language of his day. Isaiah is saying that we live in a world of many quantum possibilities. All of them are very real, and what we feel within us determines which of those possibilities we awaken and experience in our lives, and it's identified as a lost modality of prayer.
And by the way, you have a picture of that text as one of the pictures you've included for tonight.
Well, I did. I included, if listeners, if they have never seen one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I placed, first of all, a rolled-up scroll. It's the only one of its kind discovered in all the Dead Sea Scrolls library. It's the original book of Genesis, and that's the scroll that's still rolled and still intact. And then below that, I've placed a portion of the unrolled Isaiah text so that listeners, they can actually see
Yes. The
quality of the text.
Yes.
So what Isaiah is saying is there is this internal technology that we have within us. It's non-religious. There's no outer expression. There's nothing, there are no words. It says that what we feel, not what we think, what we feel in our body is the language. Now that quantum science recognizes that speaks to those forces of creation. So we're praying peace in our world, we feel peace in our hearts, we give gratitude and thanks for the peace that already exists. If we're praying about loved ones, feel as if the prayer has already been answered, feel as if the healing has already occurred. And as valid as every other mode of prayer is, this is a mode that is so empowering it was actually taken from the text 1,700 years ago.
All right. I do have a lot of people who want
Yes.
to speak to you. So let's do that while we have time. First time caller line, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hi.
Hi. This is Beryl, and I'm from New Haven, Connecticut.
Yes, ma'am.
And I love that bumper song. That's one of my favorites. Greg, I have this feeling, and it's hard to frame the question because it seems like the universe is a seamless garment. But for the first 2 weeks of August, I was taking care of 9 large cats, meaning bobcats, clouded leopards, and a Siberian lynx. And I had a tremendous sense of connection to these animals. And I was the only person that ever came in to babysit that they accepted right away.
Mm.
And I can't even explain why when I was working with these animals and feeding them, I just had a feeling that I was encountering an old soul, especially the Siberian lynx, and that's everyone's reaction to him. I also have a great deal of trouble with fibromyalgia, and I'm thinking maybe I can change this by the way I feel about things.
Hmm.
Well, I'm going to answer the two questions. The second one, in the live programs that we do, and there's information on our website about everything we've done tonight, there's information on the website. We have a video clip inside of a medicineless hospital in Beijing, China, and I talk about this in the book, and the reference is there as well if you don't get it here, where through ultrasound we can actually see a non-operable 3-inch diameter bladder cancer disappear from the screen in 2 minutes and 40 seconds in the presence of practitioners who are, there's no physical touch that's involved. They are feeling the feeling as if this woman's bladder is already healed, and we see that mirrored in her body in less than 3 minutes.
So wow.
And we've seen, there's a whole thing going on around this, Art, and we couldn't get the video up on the web tonight, obviously, but...
Well, let us do that in the future.
Okay, we can talk more about that. And as far as the animals, what I'll say is, researchers now are finding that animals respond, the language they respond to is human emotion. When you feel the feeling...
That's right. No, that's right.
That's the language. They're more than verbal, more than the image in your mind. It's the feeling.
Let me tell you something, Greg. This is the truth. That lady was obviously a cat person. I am, too. I have cats. I have a wild cat.
Mm.
And he is a typical scaredy cat. I mean, he's never going to be a normal cat. But I've been with this cat since he arrived here as... an emaciated, almost dead cat, and I'm the one who sort of brought him around day by day. I'd go in there with my armor on, and I'd reach out, and I'd pet him, and he'd go, groan at me. And over the weeks and the months, I won him over. And now, and this is the truth, the God's truth, I can go in to a room where he is, and if there's nobody else around, I can simply sit next to him, and I can emote emotion, love, and without touching him, he will simply, after a while, start to purr, and he'll roll over. And he'll roll over and throw his stomach to me.
I love stories like that. Art,
well, that's a true story. I mean, I can do that again and again. I can repeat that any time.
Well, what I can... Again, I'm going to do this very quickly. We can add to that. We've got actually research from the HeartMath Institute where they have wired animals and humans together, or they've wired them separately, but they then place them in a room together, and they can monitor what's happening with heart rate variability and emotion. We haven't even talked about all of that tonight, but where it relates to this conversation is that when the human and the animal come in the same room together, their heart rates actually sync into a rhythm of matching peaks and valleys, and those correlate directly to the quality of the emotion.
Well, the wires will demonstrate it with the equipment to the non-believers. I don't need that. I'm telling you, I can do it again and again, any time of the day or night. I can do it, period.
And Art, isn't it interesting that human emotion is a language that we lost in the West 1,700 years ago?
Right.
We're just beginning to find out how empowering that language is. Although ancient indigenous people, they didn't need to prove it either. They accepted it, and then they took it one step further. They applied it in their lives, and I think that's what we can learn from studying the Tibetan cultures and indigenous Native American, as well as the Essenes, the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
All right. Wildcard Line, you are now on the air with Greg Braden and Art Bell. Good morning.
Hi, my name is Nancy, and I'm calling from Honolulu, Hawaii.
Hi, Nancy.
Morning, Nancy.
Hi. I wanted to tell you, you were talking about the people using the energy to heal the bladder cancer.
Yes.
I saw that in a film with an exercise that they do in China called Qilil.
That's precisely what it is.
It's a friend of mine here in Phoenix, in Hawaii, healed herself of fourth-degree breast cancer with that.
It is. It's a form of Qigong called Qilil, and the reason I use it, I'm not advocating yoga or Qigong. What I'm using it to demonstrate that non-physical forces have a physical effect inside of our bodies that we can see and measure.
Art, just a couple things for you. I know you've been having a lot of trouble with your back, and if you would read a book called Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Serino, it might help, and yoga might help. And I worked in surgery for 30 years, and they have a new technique where they can put like a wire around the disc, and they put heat to it, and it shrinks the disc, so you might check into that. But what I really wanted to talk about is two things. One is my philosophy of life. I had a brain tumor for 12 years before the doctors found it. They all kept telling me it was emotional, it was in my head. So when I found out about it, I knew I had to heal my whole body, so I started going to some Buddhists, and they explained to me that we choose our parents and we choose our lessons, and that all the people we think that done all this terrible stuff to us, actually when they're in spirit on the other side, they're the ones that love us the most, and they agreed to come here to teach us our lessons. So I'm telling you, this way of thinking has really changed my life. I've been able to forgive my ex-husband, who I went through sexual abuse and all kinds of things. So I just wanted to put that to maybe help other people to be able to forgive. And what I wanted to ask Greg about is, I really feel in my heart that we have more power in each one of us than any atomic bomb that ever went off. We just haven't been taught that. And Art, I really feel in my heart that you have the power to change things on this planet, because with us all visualizing or praying at the same time.
Well, maybe the answer is that, thank you, we all have the power to change things on this planet, and collectively we have even more power. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden. Hello.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Braden, I wanted to ask you about would you prefer to call it the ether field, or what would you call this matrix of energy that pervades all of reality?
Well, since the late 1800s, it's had many names, and the ether field is the one that physics shies away from, and I think now the accepted name is the non-local quantum hologram, or the matrix of creation.
Well, one of the questions that's been bothering me, encouraging me, or something I've really been wondering about, is, do you think that field itself, could it be conscious in and of itself? And what I'm getting to is, could that be actually God, as basically spirit? I've noticed that a lot of the things you've talked about I can relate to my Christian belief. I've always wondered, what does spirit mean?
Yes.
And you also talk about faith and how that equals, or you talk about belief, like if you believe something so strongly, that to me sounds like the same thing as faith. And the Bible talks about having faith as a grain of a mustard seed.
Sure.
And
we're redefining the faith right now. It's not blind faith. Faith being now defined as feeling the feeling as if the prayer has already been answered.
But
that then becomes the faith.
You believe
quantum science says that feeling is the language that speaks to this matrix of energy that's always there, it's always present, and it links everything together. So whether we call that God or not, what I think many of the crop glyphs are saying, and many of the ancient texts are saying, is that we and God are perhaps not as separate as we would have thought in our Western traditions, and we're finding that we are actually a part of all that is. We're a part of that force.
Do you believe that the ether itself is conscious, and if so, what kind of evidences are there for that?
I believe that it is. It is. We're now defining consciousness. It is a shimmering, pulsating, glimmering field of energy. It's not out there somewhere. It's what's right in front of your face and my face right now that mirrors back to us everything that we have become from within. And these are huge concepts.
So another way of looking at it is basically it's the three-dimensional fabric of space-time reality.
Precisely, and it is a living consciousness.
Amazing. Awesome.
and this isn't just a Gregism. This is Dr. Edgar Mitchell now has a wonderful paper. It's a white paper on the web where you can read about his research with the noetic sciences and the quantum hologram.
It's really quite something to suddenly grasp it, isn't it, Colin?
So if I have hatred in my heart for another person or no matter where they are in the world,
precisely,
I actually do harm to them.
Well, rather than judging it as harm or good, the way that the ancient texts invite us to see this, this is how we move out of our judgment. Whatever we feel in our bodies, we can full well expect to see mirrored in the world around us. So if we feel hate in our bodies, that hate, we may full well expect that to come back to us in many different ways. And rather than judging it as bad or as a mistake, what we do is we say there's a way to transcend that. And as we transcend the hate and become compassion, which is what the Tibetans are teaching so beautifully right now, that it's mirrored in the chemistry of our bodies. What the researchers now have found, HeartMath is one of the research institutions, for every emotion in our bodies, there's a chemistry that matches it. So we have love chemistry and hate chemistry that either encourages or denies the life in our bodies, and it extends far beyond our bodies. It's a very different way for the Western mind to think about this.
It sure is.
And there's a lot of research bearing it out right now.
Okay, caller?
Thank you for the information.
Thank you for a great question.
Now have a good night.
All right, good night. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Greg Braden and Art Bell. Good morning.
Yeah, Stephen Phoenix.
Hi, Steve.
I got three real quick questions. Number one, where is this machine today and why isn't it being used in criminology?
Well, which machine?
The one that you just put a drop of blood in.
Okay, the Delaware technology, once Delaware passed away, it was confiscated by government sources. Some of the machines are being resurrected. Some are in private hands right now.
It's running the same gamut as the Tesla.
Sure. Tesla, Rife, Reich, Keeley, all these, they were all contemporaries, late 1800s, early 1900s. And the principles are based in radionics, and they have been duplicated many, many times.
Yeah, well, if we could duplicate them now and apply today's technology to them, we could probably produce pictures that would scare you to death.
Oh, sure. You know, these things, they're quite clunky old machines, big brass bolts. It's the principles that are there.
I understand.
Yeah.
Second question is, has anyone figured out the original 1974 transmission, the footprint, where the signal would be today?
Oh, yes.
Which solar systems have been affected by it, especially in the last 5 years?
Well, they know how many light years it would be out, and that would be the number of years since 1974, and that would be a very long way out, sir. Specifically where it would be. I intend to have Seth Shostak from SETI on Monday in the first hour of the program. We will ask him exactly that.
That's a good question.
And it'd be interesting to see if any of those solar systems or constellations are related to the creation myths of ancient cultures.
Precisely.
And my last question is, where do you come down? Were we created to be adaptive, or were we adapting to touch into the creative juices? Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
So, Art, I didn't get the first part of the last question. Where do we what come down?
Well, were we created to be adaptive, or are we adapting to be creative?
So the chicken and the egg, huh?
Yeah.
Well, what, again, we can only speculate on this. We don't know. What we do know is that there are universal themes in the oldest traditions of humankind that say we are a very unique species that is created, obviously, in the image of our Creator, and that within us we have the power, and this ties into the question the woman asked earlier. The greatest power in all of creation lives within each of us, and it is that power to touch the forces of nature that extend well beyond our bodies, and the ability to adapt to our learning experiences as we come to terms with that power.
All right, perhaps time for one quick one. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Greg Braden and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Blair from Sedona, Arizona.
Yes,
Blair, do I know you?
Yes, you do, Greg.
I thought I did. Good morning, Blair.
Good morning, Greg. The term quantum physics has been used a lot, Greg.
Yes.
And a lot of people know what it means, but there are some that don't. Would you give us a quick definition of quantum as
right.
it has to do with your discussion?
Okay.
Certainly. Good question. Thanks for calling in, Blair.
Sure.
It's the term. It is a very good question. We toss it around so much, we take it for granted. Everyone knows. the world around us is not a solid, continuous world, and physics was developed early in this century, theorized in 1900 by Max Planck, that says the reality that we see is solid and continuous is actually made of short bursts of energy, tiny energy packets called quanta, Q-U-A-N-T-A. So quantum physics is the study of those short, rapid bursts of energy that our eyes and our minds link together to give us the illusion of what looks like a solid, continuous world. So it's actually very short bursts of energy. Is what we're seeing, and this was the difficulty between Max Planck's theories of quantum physics and Einstein's theories of relativity. They didn't match very well, and this is where the string theories now are actually including both of them, saying both must be present to unify all of these theories into a single umbrella or a global understanding of the energy and creation.
You know, one of my favorite movies was Somewhere in Time. Where time travel was achieved virtually by emotion.
Mm.
Now, theoretical physicists tell us that it will take enormous amounts of power to achieve time travel. They think it may be possible. Enormous power required, though. But what if, at the quantum level, once we've mastered these transmissions by emotion, gee, maybe something like that might be possible.
Oh, there's another program right there.
That's right. That's a whole other program.
I want to say thank you for being such a gracious host tonight.
Greg, thank you for being here. Bless your heart. We'll have you back.
I look forward to that. Take good care.
Good night, my friend.
Right, good night.
And his book, again, is The Isaiah Effect. If you want to read more about what you've heard so much about tonight, hop over to Amazon.com. My website will take you over to Amazon.com, and you can grab the book and read much more about it, because if you've been listening carefully, I suspect for many of you, the light bulb went on very brightly. Listen, that's it. We're going to repeat the first hour, again, a very important hour coming up next. I'm Art Bell from the high desert. Ta-ta.